Go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, midweek on the horn. It is the 23rd day of August, 2017. This program is live. Like it, well, that's how we work here. We work live. And glad to have you along. If you would like to be part of the extended horn experience, the Madcap Mary Zany Wacky real-time multimedia experience. Well, just run on over to headonradionetwork.com and click on the chat room, pick yourself out a screen name and a password, and you will immediately be part of the experience. And while there, you will be met by the folks who got here early, namely Anatole and Hoghead and Jug of Punch, and BT Blom, and Midweek Prayer Meeting Wednesday Utility Chat Room Moderator, and all-around great guy, returned from eclipse viewing, Steve, from Georgistan. Stand by. Okay. Oh, hi. I'm Bob Kincaid. And this is the horn for Wednesday. Usually we do prayer meeting Wednesday on Wednesdays. But instead, I'm going to dispense with the prayer meeting Wednesday shtick and go immediately to a conversation. Carol Baker put me in touch with Dr. Michael Phillips. And he's from, Dr. Phillips grew up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Got himself a journalism degree from the University of Texas at Arlington back in 1983. And then spent 7 years as a real, live, honest-goodness, working professional reporter. And then among which included some time at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. He then earned a master's degree at the University of California, Riverside in 1994, and then went on to get a Ph.D. in history from the University of Texas at Austin in 2002. Fine history department. And ever since, going back to 2007, so about 10 years, for the last 10 years or so, Dr. Phillips has taught American history at Collin College in Plano, Texas. With his wife, Betsy Frioff, he's currently writing a trilogy of books on Texas race relations, The Strange Career of Eugenics in Texas, Whitewash, the Civil War and Reconstruction in Texas Memory, and God Carved in Night, African Americans and the Talented Tenth in Texas. Now, obviously, that is well past being an impressive resume. Dr. Phillips takes his charge seriously, and as such, knows the history of things like Confederate monuments, Confederate memorials, knows why they're there, and has felt a a moral urgency to encourage their removal. Well, Dr. Phillips is with us right now from Texas, and he has found the going something less than peaceful. Dr. Phillips, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for taking time to talk with us at the Horn this evening.
No problem.
You have received death, at least, if not death threats, a death threat that you take to be credible over these memorials?
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, when people send these things, they keep it vague enough that it's meant to be intimidating, but he doesn't specifically say he's going to, whoever the email writer, it could be a woman, theoretically, the writer doesn't specifically say they're going to cause harm, but they tell me harm could befall me. And I'm not really sure how much, I mean, I could read the email to you. I don't know if you want the language. There are no four-letter words, but there's a very ugly racial slur that's repeated twice here. Would you want me to read it?
Well, you know, you're a former journalist, and I'm a former journalist, and I've taken the position here that if the word the word should probably be used even in polite journalism, if it is used in a journalistic sense. In other words, not for purposes. But yeah, what did you? Let's back up for a minute, Dr. Phillips. What were you doing that got this response?
Well, I've been part of a movement, and we've been working on this for much of the summer. And we've been trying to get the city of Dallas to take down a large number of Confederate monuments. We want those taken down. There are a number of schools named after Confederate figures in Dallas. We want those names changed. There's some symbols at this Fair Park, which is where the State Fair of Texas is held every year, where the Cotton Bowl is, that, you know, where that game used to be played. So we're trying to take it down, all these Confederate symbols. And our momentum really picked up when New Orleans, you know, took down their monuments, and Mitch Landrieu made that incredible speech. So I circulated a letter amongst scholars and members of the clergy in Dallas. We got 131 prominent signatures on the document. I wrote a guest column for the Dallas Morning News. They published the open letter with the signatures from all those scholars in the Dallas Morning News. And it's been a little crazy because I've been on TV all the time. So I'm out there, you know, in the public. And when the open letter we wrote calling for the removal of the Confederate monuments was published in the Dallas Morning News, they published my college email address. Plus, it's public, right? And so yesterday, I open up my work email, and this is the email I got. And it's shocking, the language, but this really, I think this is a moment of truth, just like Charleston is. This shows what these monuments are really about. The writer said, and here's where the offensive language begins, right at the start. "Hey, nigger lover, leave the Confederate monuments alone. If you keep yelling for their removal, you're liable to make someone mad, and they will take you out. If I was you, I would be looking over my shoulder to see who's coming up behind me. They may not be friendly." And then he closes with this sentence, "Nigger lives don't matter." Now, that last sentence, I think, really reveals, exposes a lie, because the pro-Confederate symbols people, the people who defend the Confederate battle flag, always say it's heritage, not hate.
Right.
And I think what happened, in Charleston and emails like this, and I've gotten, it's interesting. I've gotten emails where people have called me a Yankee, and I have to point out I was born at a Marine Corps base in North Carolina, and I grew up in Dallas. You know, my parents are from Mobile and New Orleans. I've been called a carpetbagger. I've been called a scalawag. I've gotten anti-Semitic mail because people assume, I guess, I'm Jewish. One email I got referred to me as Mikhail Philipstein. I guess they're trying to imply I'm communist and Jewish. there have been all kinds of crazy things about, you know, that the Jews are going to get theirs, and, you know, black people are murdering gay people in Dallas and they deserve it for being effeminate, et cetera, et cetera. So I really feel we're seeing...
You struck the mother lode.
This has been a truth we've been trying to expose for years. I have a friend who co-wrote the open letter with me, Edward Sebesta. He's been researching what scholars call the neo-Confederate movement. And let's explain that real quickly. The neo-Confederate movement was a propaganda campaign waged by the South right after the Civil War. And that's the thing about the Civil War. The South lost the war, but they won the peace. They totally altered how people remembered that period, the war and Reconstruction. And so these monuments were part of that campaign. And what they're trying to do is whitewash the past and to suggest that the Civil War wasn't about slavery, but it was about quote-unquote states' rights. What they don't mention is the state right is the right to allow citizens to buy and sell human beings. That's what the state right is. And here's the thing. The Confederates were never embarrassed about that. When these states seceded from the Union, they said it was about slavery. But after the war, it was really important to basically sanitize that history and suggest that these men who waged treason against the United States and plunged the country into a war that killed over 700,000 Americans, we know now, and would have split the country in two and left it weaker, that these men somehow are patriots and heroes. And I would suggest they're patriotic as Timothy McVeigh. This is clear-cut case of treason, and yet we have statues to these men. And these also are monuments to white supremacy. In Dallas and in other cities, we force African-American parents to walk under the shadows of these statues of men who were slave owners and who fought against, for the most part, black voting rights. There's one prominent Confederate general who became an advocate of black voting rights after the war, and that was James Longstreet. And there's exactly one statue of him in the South, and that's in Georgia. Nowhere else do you find him.
And he was denounced as a race traitor. Among other things, he sided on the Reconstruction side.
Right.
And I mean, there's quite a history there. Well, let me. I was born and raised in Alabama, so I know.
Okay. Yeah. My dad was from Mobile.
I was in Mobile 2 weeks ago. If you've got roots in the South, and you've got a conscience, you almost by definition have some internal struggle going on because you love the region, you love the people, and you absolutely despise the attitudes. I was raised in Northwest Alabama, and I was talking last night on this program about the, because every county courthouse lawn has one of these, the ubiquitous Confederate soldier statue.
Right. And okay, real quickly.
Yeah.
In Gainesville, Texas, which is real close to Dallas, they have a courthouse statue like you're talking about. And these inscriptions often make it very clear. There's an inscription on this monument. And Gainesville was an infamous scene during the time. In 1862, 1 year into the war, they massacred. They hanged on one day, 42 suspected pro-Union people. Just, it was a massacre. And so they put up this Confederate monument, and on the monument it says at the base in an inscription, "No land ever rose so white and fair, no nation fell so free of crime," right where this massacre was. So they say the nation's white and that there was no crime ever committed by the Confederacy. So anyway, I'm sorry.
No, that's breathtaking, because that's a lot more than it says on the monument that I saw while I was gone. There's a blank flag sculpture. I pointed it. It's, you know, sort of a white flag of surrender, but it's it just says CSA 1861 to 1865. Because even in 1911, when this thing was erected, it had a tinge. Why not? You know, why didn't they put the Confederate flag on there, because that would have been seen as overt, an overt act of sedition or perhaps treason.
Right.
But as a historian, maybe you can answer this question, Dr. Phillips. I noted that that statue and many others were erected by the United Daughters of the Confederacy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, this is a so-called heritage group. So a couple of things. That's
was that sort of a subterfuge campaign?
No, I mean, the UDC was definitely involved, and it's important to realize the worldview of the United Daughters of the Confederacy. They really did, they raised the funds, they helped pay for maintenance of these statues, they lobbied governments, and they ended up building, I mean, places like the Rocky Mountain West, you know, places, modern states that hadn't entered the Union yet when the Civil War ended, got Confederate memorials. States outside of the South got memorials. And this was part of this propaganda effort to basically make the South into the good guys, the noble losers of the war, the lost cause. And this was an explicitly racist organization, too. They had a woman named Mildred Rutherford, who was they called her the historian general of the UDC. And she would hold essay contests about the Confederacy, about the Civil War and Reconstruction. And in some of their contests, they asked for heroic essays about the Ku Klux Klan. And people won awards. There was a young woman in Seattle, actually, who got what was described as a loving cup for writing about the heroic efforts of the Ku Klux Klan to save the South from what they used to call Negro rule. So this is explicitly a white supremacist group. The membership is open. It's like the Daughters of the American Revolution. You have to be a descendant of a Confederate veteran or the actual, you know, the early days, an actual daughter of a Confederate soldier. And it's important to know the time frame that these monuments went up. They started being built in the 1890s to the 1930s. And this is exactly the time when you had the Populist Party collapse, which was a biracial political movement that was radical, that, for instance, was fighting for government ownership of the railroads and the telegraph lines. You had a Colored Farmers Alliance and a Southern Farmers Alliance. The Southern Farmers Alliance was white. Colored Farmers Alliance was black. They were fighting for these radical reforms. So that frightened traditional powerful people in the South, traditional elites. And then to separate these African Americans and whites politically and physically, that's when you begin to have Jim Crow laws passed in this time period. That's when you begin to have poll taxes and literacy tests passed to strip African Americans of voting. There was actually a pause between the end of the Civil War and Reconstruction and when the disenfranchisement laws were passed. And then most horrifically, in the 1890s, like, for instance, Dallas's oldest public sculpture is the Confederate War Memorial. It's in it's near the Dallas Convention Center. It got relocated. It was originally a city park. That was built in 1896. That decade, there was an average of 175 lynchings a year in the United States. And there were years where there were more than 200 lynchings. In other words, one every other day. And these lynchings involved, you know, thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of people show up to watch a black man burned alive or castrated before he was hanged, et cetera. And so the peak period of lynchings is from the 1890s to the 1930s when these statues are being built. One last thing, a spike within this period of the monument building was from 1915 to 1925. 1915 was the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan, the second Ku Klux Klan, which became a national power. And for 10 years until the Klan collapses, that's when there's a real binge of monument building. And so this is the political context of these monuments, and this is really a loud declaration. Again, it didn't matter what the result of the Civil War was. White Southerners were saying to the federal government, you don't count. We run our region. We're a country within a country. And essentially, there was a psychological Berlin Wall built around the South that lasted until finally after World War II, these laws began to crumble and African Americans regained the right to vote that they gained during Reconstruction.
And coincident with this same time period, Dr. Phillips, if I'm correct, tell me if I'm not, you have the actual extension of this philosophy and this mindset into the federal government itself in the form of Woodrow Wilson, who was such a fan of D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation that he screened it at the White House. And people don't necessarily know that the book upon which Birth of a Nation mm-hmm. Was based was simply called The Klansman. And in that book, The Klansman is the hero.
Oh, and in the movie, too. And the author of that novel is a man named Thomas Dixon, who was a minister. And one of the things he said, one of his motives for writing that book was to fill white women with an abhorrence for black men, because he thought the country would be doomed if you had what was then called miscegenation. You had families created by mixed race couples, that would destroy the white race and destroy the nation. And of course, one of the central characters, both in the book, The Klansman, and the movie, The Birth of a Nation, which was screened in the White House in 1915, was Gus, who's a black Union soldier. He's played by a white actor in blackface in the movie. And he attempts to rape a white woman. And that's given as the excuse for the Ku Klux Klan rising. The Klan was actually a terrorist group aimed at disenfranchising African Americans who had just gained the right to vote and to force them to continue to work for their former masters. And so Wilson sees the movie in 1915, and he says, this is like history written with lightning, and the terrible thing is it's also true. And so they made that, it's a silent movie. So that became the title card, the first thing you saw when you saw the movie, because D.W. Griffith knew that this was going to be a controversial film. You're making the Klan heroes, right? And this has remained, that movie has been a major Klan recruitment film since that period. And by the way, the Sons of Confederate Veterans, the so-called Heritage Group, and the United Daughters of Confederacy, for decades, going to the 1970s and beyond, would show that movie at their meetings, their conventions. And so this is part of that heritage, part of the quote-unquote heritage of these monument defenders. So it's horrific. But anyway, that period when the Birth of a Nation was released, that's when you begin to have probably the largest group of monuments built in the country.
And so bringing it back to the present, you got involved with this group seeking to take down and not just take down statues, but perhaps rename schools. I mean, public institutions, that sort of thing.
We have a school in Dallas, Texas, an elementary school named after a war criminal. There's a man named William Cabell, and he's part of a prominent family in Dallas that's been, really influential, civic leaders, business leaders since the Civil War. And William Cabell was a brigadier general in the Confederate Army, and he led troops who massacred, wounded African-American Union soldiers who had surrendered. It's like if we had a elementary school named after William Calley, the man responsible for the My Lai massacre.
Right.
We've got this man under military law, he should have been hanged. And instead he comes back and he gets elected mayor three different times and he has a school named after him. Go ahead.
I was going to say, underpinning all of this is the fact that at whatever time these institutions were named, it's not just, he had it. Yeah, like all human beings, he was flawed, but he had his good points. These are actual celebrations of their Confederate, arguably treasonous service. There's a on the campus of Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia. I found this out by a roundabout way. I was standing at the courthouse in Spencer, West Virginia, a couple of weeks ago. And they have, and this thing went up, that suddenly, we've got a Confederate trail. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And,
yeah, I mean, and there's actually a Jefferson Davis Highway, too, by the way. I don't know if you knew that.
There's probably a few of them. But in this particular instance, there was a Confederate general by the name of Jenkins.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a proud son of a wealthy elite class family in what was then Cabell County. That's what reminded me. Cabell County,
yes.
Virginia at the time. By the war's end, it's Cabell County, West Virginia. As a result, after the war, you know, he comes back. He gets the blanket pardon that's issued, and then they build a building in the 1930s, like 1937.
Mm-hmm.
On the campus of this university, which is one of the two largest universities in West Virginia, and they name it after him. They didn't name it after him because of what he did after the war. They named it after him because of what he did during the war. And yes, And African American students at Marshall University have to walk into that building every day. And to a certain extent, even walking into the building, and I think you'll agree with me here, after walking into the building, the act of walking into the building is an act of remembrance.
And it's an act of humiliation repeated every day because, of course, these buildings, the names of the buildings tower above you. These statues are like Olympian statues of gods, right? And, these are statues of people who would have kept those students in perpetual bondage. So psychologically, it's one of those things. It's part of the architecture of white supremacy. And by the way, when they dedicated these monuments, the intent of the monuments is very clear. Like, for instance, at the University of North Carolina, when they were dedicating a Confederate monument at that campus, they brought a man on, and I just recently read this speech, the dedication speech, and he's talking during this address about, and this was in the records of the North Carolina Sons of Confederate Veterans. He was saying we were fighting, meaning the Confederates, to preserve the Anglo-Saxon race, and then he brags about how a few weeks after Appomattox, after Robert E. Lee surrendered, he was, back in his hometown, and there was an African American woman who he claimed was insulting a white woman, and so he refers to her as a Negro wench, and he brags in this dedication speech about horsewhipping her. That's part of the dedication ceremony for this particular Confederate monument. So even the dedication ceremonies, were often really racist. Now, a strange thing in Dallas built in 1936 a statue of Robert E. Lee, and they took there's a neighborhood in Dallas called Oaklawn, and they turned Oaklawn into Robert E. Lee Park. And they Franklin Roosevelt came down to basically dedicate the statue, and he made a one-paragraph speech. And if you remember, during this time, Texas was, like a lot of southern states, a one-party state, and this was an era where the Democrats were segregationists. They later became segregationist Republicans, as I like to point out when you get to the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But anyway, Roosevelt gets down there, and he unveils the statue, and on the grounds of that park, and I find this particularly grotesque, they build a replica of Robert E. Lee's plantation home. It's called Arlington House, and it's a replica of the original. Now, I want you to think about that, because this is a place where people have weddings. This is a place where they have Christmas parties. What happened in the big house and the grounds surrounding a plantation home? Human beings were whipped. Families were broken up. Slave women were raped. And people go there to celebrate holidays and celebrate their wedding and to get photographed there. And if you're inside that replica, there's a portrait of Robert E. Lee by himself. There's a portrait of Robert E. Lee by Stonewall Jackson. The whole Confederate milieu is just totally draped everywhere. You know, you're enveloped in Confederate nostalgia. And I just find that morally repulsive. Dallas ministers conduct ceremonies there. And I'm wondering what the moral message is. It's almost like, and people get shocked by this comparison, but I don't think it's inappropriate. It's like if they had built a replica of the bunker where Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun had gotten married. And people went there to have their wedding ceremonies. Yeah, just totally the moral message sent by making that a place of celebration, a replica of a site of intense human suffering, I can't comprehend.
Well, and that raises another question, Dr. Phillips. How much of this, I mean, when you hear the average Confederate sympathizer spewing their filth, that's one thing. But as you, as a real live, honest to God historian, and me as a lay lover of history, I'm a hopeless nerd. If I'm in Washington D.C., I read every plaque. I stop and I look at every statue. I can't help myself. I can't. I have to know this stuff. I read historical markers along the side of the road. Okay.
Right.
I have a sneaking suspicion that I am outside the realm of the norm where that's concerned. Is to what extent does just plain ignorance play in this? If you don't know anything about anything that you and I have discussed over the course of the last 20 minutes or so, does that make you more likely to say, well, they're erasing history? Where ordinary workaday America, are we witnessing the triumph of ignorance or the triumph of hate? Oh dear. I have lost Dr. Phillips. Stand by, please.
You have reached 21.
Okay, so I don't know what's happening there. We'll try to. Head on.
Yeah, hi. I'm Michael Phillips.
Yeah,
I
don't know what happened there, but you were just.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah. So we got cut off, but the signal dropped. But I think we're back, and you're coming in strong.
Okay,
but anyway,
great.
I'm sorry, I missed your last point.
Well, the question was, for people who don't know much history, are the objections that we witness now, where they say things like "you're erasing history," how much of that is ignorance versus how much of that is, active, nostalgia for what they see as the good old days?
Well, I mean, first of all, war is the, by a wide margin, the most written about topic in American history. You have thousands and thousands of books. You know, you have a book on almost every single brigade that fought in the Civil War. So if the monuments come down, you're not going to lose history. You know, I've heard the joke that, you know, there's a painting, the revolutionaries after the Declaration of Independence was released, you know, pulling down a statue of King George III, and someone joked, that's why we don't know anything about American Revolution, right? Because they pulled the statues down.
Yeah.
People are going to know about the Civil War. You know, that's what books are for. That's what museums are for. That's what documentaries are for. Here's the thing. These monuments are not history. They're propaganda. And you learn no more truthful information from looking at a monument than you do from looking at Leni Riefenstahl's film, The Triumph of the Will. You know, you're not going to learn anything accurate about the Third Reich from that other than the pageantry of it. And these monuments don't even provide much information. You mentioned plaques, but like the Robert E. Lee statue, at Lee Park in Dallas. It doesn't even have his birth and death dates. It's just his name, you know, and the statue. These are not history. These are propaganda. And they're designed to horrify people who did horrific things.
And if I'm not mistaken, part of the irony in all of this is that to the extent that he was asked about it while he was alive, Robert E. Lee said specifically that there should not be monuments to the Confederacy or the Confederate cause or to the war. Did he
right.
not?
Right. Yeah, no, he did, absolutely, because he thought, and he also was against, because he felt like that would perpetuate regional divisions, and it would make the process of getting over the Civil War harder. There's not much I admire about Robert E. Lee. There's a horrific slave narrative. One escaped slave who ran away and he was captured, and Lee ordered him whipped 50 times and salt rubbed in his wound so he'd be taught a lesson. And he was a fierce opponent of black voting rights, but he was smart enough to realize how this would perpetuate, you know, that it would make concrete the Mason-Dixon line. The country would not reintegrate as a single unit. And he was right about that.
And he had seen the righteous ass-whipping that was laid down on the South as a result of the rebellion, and did not want to see that happen again.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're absolutely true. You're not going to learn. In other words, you know, these are artifacts of propaganda, and if you're removing them, you're not erasing history. Ideally, what I would like is I would like these statues taken down, put in storage until a place is built for them. And what I would like would be scholarly museums where you have PhDs in history, cultural geography, et cetera, put together these monuments, these artifacts, in an exhibit that explains how this was a propaganda campaign and how the main purpose was to legitimize segregation and other forms of racial oppression in the 20th century, and to legitimize denying African Americans the right to vote. And and the thing is, there's hypocrisy here. Like, for instance, in Dallas, we had the Confederate War Memorial built in 1896. They moved it. It's already been moved. They moved it in the 1950s. And this is a story that tells you everything you need to know about Dallas's racial politics. They moved that memorial, that Confederate memorial, to make room for what was called R.L. Thornton Freeway. R.L. Thornton Freeway was named after a mayor of Dallas who was mayor when Kennedy was killed. R.L. Thornton was a former Klansman. So a Confederate memorial was moved to make room for a highway named after a Klansman. And I think that just captures Dallas history right there.
Absolutely, in two or three short sentences, that's breathtaking.
You know, and by the way, there's a movement, and I applaud it, to rename that highway because it still has the name. So that's what we need to, and I think that it really. Cities with these monuments, and this is why I think they're going to go down, because commerce always determines everything in this country, unfortunately. The bottom line is ultimately the most important thing. And you had the Dillon Roof massacre in Charleston, you know, the massacre of those people at Mother Emanuel Church. And then beyond that, then you had the events in Charlottesville, led by Richard Spencer. And I guess you know what town he grew up in, right? Do you know what town Richard Spencer grew up in?
New
the
Orleans?
Right guy?
No,
he grew up in Dallas.
Oh.
He grew up in Dallas, Texas. Yeah, he lived in the Preston Hollow neighborhood, which is home to Ross Perot and T. Boone Pickens, the oil man, and George W. Bush lives there now.
Not that's exactly the ghetto.
No, not the hood, no. So that was really, you know, that's an aspect there. But when they held that alt-right rally, that really did something psychologically, because the heritage not hate argument, the heritage not hate rationalization for these monuments, was exposed as a lie for everybody, because now the Confederate battle flag is associated permanently in many people's minds with the swastika. Because those were, you know, not just neo-Confederates marching there, but there were actual Nazis, modern-day Nazis marching there. And that's awfully hard to buy. And so one thing that happened real quickly, a lot of states have Six Flags parks. I don't know if you've
heard this story. Yes, I've been to Six Flags over everywhere.
Yeah, and it originated in Arlington, Texas, actually. Six Flags over Texas is what it originally was. And so they had the different flags. That Texas was under during different historic periods, and one of them was Confederacy. And you used to have a part, it was a theme park, and there used to be a part of the park that was called the Confederacy. And you had a plantation and all this other stuff. And Six Flags looked at this and said, oh my gosh, Confederacy, not just slavery, but now Nazis, and now they're just flying American flags there. The Six Flags are the American flag. Six American flags are the symbol. And so that really, this is what's going to happen, is businesses everywhere are going to begin to distance themselves from the symbol. And that's unfortunately how progress happens. It happens with that, and then it happens when people die, unfortunately. You know, in 1964, you had that horrific bombing of that 16th, Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. And you had those four little girls die, and they were debating the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and that really pushed it over the top, those deaths. And I think that Heather Heyer's death, unfortunately, that's a tragedy, but I think this is going to really, and you can see it's accelerating the removal of these monuments everywhere. My alma mater, UT Austin, had removed a Jefferson Davis statue, but they left Robert E. Lee in place, and they left three other Confederate figures in place. And the statues near the UT Tower, they went down. They came down one night, overnight. They just brought them down, shortly after the Charlottesville rally. So Richard Spencer made an impact, but not in the way he planned regarding these monuments.
And I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but today, I guess a Confederate tried to slash away the black drape covering Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville.
And that's what I'm worried about. Dallas, that's where Plano is just north of Dallas. And so I've been involved in this movement in Dallas to take the monuments down. And we've got potentially a very dangerous situation, because we have a mayor of Dallas who is wanting to have like this endless discussion about the monuments. And we're trying to say, no, vote to take them down, and then we can have a discussion about why the monuments were taken down. But he wants to put off a vote. There's a resolution for the Dallas City Council whether or not to take the monuments down. Right now, he's pushing for September 27th. Now, someone's going to be visiting Dallas, Texas on September 27th, Donald Trump.
Oh, really?
And so he's going to be bringing the type of following he has to Dallas when this is being...
That's begging for a riot. That's begging
absolutely
for a riot.
Yeah, and so you have this. So you're going to have to increase security at the Dallas City Council. You're going to have security for the Trump rally. And then you have to worry about where all the monuments are and where the Dallas police resources are going to be stretched to the absolute limit and maybe beyond their limit.
Well, one of the things that's troubling to me that I think has been under-considered and under-reported, Dr. Phillips, is the fact that you had this tiki putsch, for lack of a better term,
yes,
in Charlottesville. And then this weekend, we all said, well, see, we showed those Nazis because they sort of fizzled in Boston. But
right,
there's a distinct difference between the two locales. And I would say that if we extrapolate, with past being prologue into the event you're talking about in Dallas, that does not bode well, because the reason the Nazis didn't get any traction in Dallas was because they couldn't bring their guns. All right.
Yeah.
Couple of people who tried to bring guns got busted, because you can't
open
carry in Boston. And you can open carry.
In Texas, you can.
Yeah, you can open carry son of a gun in downtown Dallas, right?
Oh, they just made it legal to carry guns on college campuses here.
Right.
I mean, they're and in fact, they're debating constitutional carry. Is there no limitation? You could go into an explosives factory and carry a weapon if it passes. So, no, this, you know, and of course, Texas has a very high concentration of militias and hate groups and, you know, far-right groups, and there's still Klan chapters here, neo-Nazi groups in Texas. So
Alex Jones.
Alex Jones in Austin. It is, you know, I mean, I remember – and to some degree, this is still true. You know, when Kennedy came to visit and they were looking at the Dallas Morning News and the ad that, you know, it was accusing Kennedy of treason, and Kennedy said, this is nut country. Well, to a large degree, that's still true in a lot of Texas. So, you know, very, you know, they're progressives here. I don't want to. This is really volatile, and potentially we could have another Charlottesville, and we've been urging the mayor to resolve this issue as soon as possible. And when the decision is made, to try to do it in a way that is the least provocative, but it gets it done. Because once the monuments are gone, they're gone forever, and then we can move on and talk about what.
And by the Confederates' own logic, once the monuments are gone, they'll forget the Civil War.
Right, exactly, because that's the only thing.
And then we can finally have a little peace.
Right, the Civil War might actually be over in some way. Yeah, so that's it. You know, the one other thing I need to point out is part of the problem is the textbooks, the school textbooks, are in a way Confederate monuments themselves.
Yes,
the way the Civil War is still taught through these textbooks minimizes slavery as the issue. And does not as honestly address the cruelty of slavery that needs to the point that, you know, we have right-wing nutcases on the Texas State School Board. And
yes, you do.
They draw up a list of recommended textbooks to be used across the state. And so the meet the standards set by this Texas School Board because it's – yeah, such a massive market for textbooks. And this one Houston parent just a few years ago discovered that the textbook was referring to slaves as immigrant workers. That's the terminology.
Oh, I remember that. And in fact, at a city council meeting in some little burg in North Carolina, state of your birth, they had a meeting the other night where some fellow who was the descendant of slave owners said, well, I wouldn't really refer to them as slaves. I'd just call them workers.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's, war is peace, right? Ignorance is strength, et cetera.
And, I don't know the last time that I saw a worker walk in and say, boss, I need a raise, and get 50 lashes and salt rubbed in his wounds for his trouble.
Right. This is, this deceit. To a large degree, I mean, this is a history people don't realize. This was national, this propaganda. I mean, The Birth of a Nation, the novel was written by a Southerner, and D.W. Griffith was a Southerner, but it was made in Hollywood. And it was a massive hit because that's the way people all across the country had come to understand the Civil War, slavery, and that whole history because of the history profession, of which, you know, I'm part of it now. And we're trying to undo the damage historians did in the early era. There was an historian at Columbia University in New York named William Dunning who trained several generations of historians who wrote the textbooks that were adopted by school districts across the country. And it was all pro-Confederate in its orientation. The abolitionists were nuts. They're the ones who caused the Civil War. The South would have worked out the slavery issue on their own if they'd just been left alone. African Americans weren't prepared to be citizens. These are all the things. And when I've been at rallies in Dallas where we get the counter-protesters with their battle flags, they repeat to me all these lies about the past. And this is part of the work that the monuments do. They misinform intentionally, and those defenders of the monuments illustrate the harm to understanding of the past that these monuments do.
And we've had a magnificent conversation, Dr. Phillips. I hope we'll have another sometime soon. Let me just throw, and I mentioned this on the program a few nights ago. Like I said, I was down south a couple of weeks back. I stopped on the Natchez Trace Parkway, and at the place where the ferry across the Tennessee River used to be, and there were of course interpretive markers to tell you about the. They were just called stands along the Natchez Trace. This one was owned by a man who was half Scots and half Chickasaw Indian. He was a slave owner.
Right.
But as a historian, you know the value of primary sources. It is much more informative to know what someone actually said about something than knowing what somebody said about something that somebody said about somebody said. So on one of these interpretive markers, there's a quote from somebody who stayed at that stand, who said, "Passed the night in a barn with several travelers, comma, 50 Indians, comma, and then there's just a blank space." Now, you want to talk about erasing history?
Yeah.
What had been blanked out, because I remember it from my childhood, is a reference to slaves.
Right. Yeah.
They had completely erased the slave presence from that very place.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, when I was in school, I was going to elementary school in the 60s and the early 70s, and I don't remember a single African American name mentioned, not even Frederick Douglass, in any of the American history I learned in public school, even when I got to high school. And the most exposure I got to African American history and the history of slavery was actually when I was 16, when the TV show Roots came on. That was my big exposure, you know. And I'd read books aimed at college audiences. I was a little precocious as a kid, but I didn't get it from the public schools, and that certainly wasn't ever a theme. And there was no history of the civil rights movement. No one was ever told about W.B. Du Bois or Booker T. Washington or men like that. That is the memory hole. That's the Orwellian memory hole that this part is. I call this whole neo-Confederate project the American equivalent of Holocaust denial.
You have to
confront that, or our race relations are never going to get better unless we understand the past and we understand how we got there. And that's why this monument issue is totally relevant to our time. The violence with police and their treatment of African Americans, the poverty in inner cities, the hostility to programs like Head Start and programs like that. All of this is so tied to the psychology that created those monuments that you have to begin to dismantle. This is the architecture of racism in America. The monuments are a critical part of that.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Let me ask you this as we wind things up: is this having any impact on your teaching career?
This has been happening during the summer, so we'll find out. My first day back is on the 28th, and we'll see how people respond. But I haven't, other than getting hostile emails and, some pretty threatening ones, being widely recognized now. People see me and they know who I am. Oh, I saw you on TV, which can be a good thing and a bad thing. It's not going to, I've studied the project or the neo-Confederacy phenomena in more detail while I've been doing this. So I think it'll sharpen my lecture some. I think race is the struggle, the theme, the topic that has defined American history more than any other.
From the very moment the first white foot sets foot on this continent, I agree with you.
Absolutely. We talk about that rather than we talk about class because of that reason. We don't deal with the class inequality because we've been diverted to think about race. And, of course, the country is born in genocide and slavery.
Absolutely. And an observation coming from our mutual friend Carol Baker, who says, can we ask our friends in Germany how many statues they have of Hitler, Rommel, Keitel, Himmler, Jodl, and the like?
I don't know if you have time for this story real briefly. I was in Italy back in 2001. And, of course, there are no statues of Mussolini there in public spaces. There's one place where they had an Olympic village because Rome was going to host the Olympics in 1940, and it got canceled because of World War II. The only other place you find a reference to Mussolini is at his gravesite. And you know what that place has become? It's become a magnet for neo-fascists,
absolutely,
Nazis, et cetera. And in Europe, by the way, where they banned the swastika as a symbol in many countries, they fly Confederate battle flags as a substitute because they understand what those flags mean. And when Trump was speaking in Warsaw, you know, which has a right-wing government, the audience was filled with Polish citizens waving Confederate battle flags.
It absolutely was.
It has to come down, all of it.
Yeah, as for me, you know, if they wanted to put up a monument at that, what was it, a gas station in Milan, of a statue of Mussolini hanging upside down by his ankles and in Italian and English and several other languages, so always with fascists, that's okay by me. That would be immediately vandalized. But you know, there are so many aspects to this entire issue, Dr. Phillips. I've mentioned on this program in the past, you know, Booker T. Washington was born a slave in what is now West Virginia, not very far from here. And they tried to put up a monument to him in the little community where he was born.
Right.
And eventually it had to be moved to the grounds of the Capitol complex because in the little community where he was born, it was constantly being spray painted with, you know, that word.
Sure. Yeah. One other little bizarre story, because we were talking about the United Daughters of the Confederacy. They actually campaigned. They wanted to build what they called in their literature a statue honoring Mammy. It was called a Mammy statue, which was, you know, like the character in Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
And this was statue was supposed to represent the faithful slave who stuck by, you know, her master and served him and loved, you know, slaves who, and they actually got a $200,000 appropriation from the U.S. Senate in 1923, when the Klan was at its peak of power nationwide, and the House killed that project, but it was intended to go up in Washington, D.C., not all that far from the Lincoln Memorial, you know, which, you know, was being finished at that time. So I mean, this is one of the most successful propaganda campaigns ever. It's as if you had had Hitler defeated, but somehow the people in Germany, after Hitler committed suicide, had started putting up monuments and had convinced people that the Nazis were noble losers. That's what this is like.
And oddly enough, what leads to the rise of the Third Reich is the notion that Hitler and the brown shirts helped create in the interbellum period after 1918 and before 1939. Of the German Reich under Wilhelm as a lost cause. They used the same ideas, and for all I know, they picked it up from the Confederacy.
They very well could have, you know, because, I mean, it's a similar concept, you know, that there was betrayal. You know, of course, there are Confederate myths about who betrayed the South. There was a Jewish member of the Confederate government who served several posts who was blamed, you know. And
Judah Benjamin.
You had this Judah Benjamin. And he was basically portrayed as a Judas who was working to undermine. He's like a double agent or something. And that's part of the mythology, too. And, of course, we mentioned Longstreet before, that supposedly it's his fault that the Battle of Gettysburg was fought. And, of course, he was an advocate of black voting.
They never get around to really blaming that exhausted, probably nearsighted dude from North Carolina who blew away Stonewall Jackson. He never enters the conversation for some reason or another. Judah
or
Benjamin.
They never,
I was going to say, Judah Benjamin, by the way, knew that he was a marked man. He fled with Jefferson Davis, split off from Davis, avoided capture, crossed the Atlantic, and became once more fabulously wealthy as a lawyer in London. Never came home again.
Right, absolutely, yeah. So, you know, because if anyone would have been prosecuted, because that's the thing, you can't find another example in the world where you've had such a bloody failed rebellion and had the leaders of that failed rebellion, the people who sought to destroy the government as it existed, have statues built after them, schools named after them, parks named after them, and so on. Yeah, those people usually are executed.
Well,
and that didn't happen.
No, and I've argued that it should have. I'm not a fan of the death penalty, but you know, sometimes people just need to go up against the wall. You know, when you do things like lead treasonous insurrections against the civil popular, you know, government.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I will say, Dr. Yeah. Phillips, I take issue with you on one thing.
Okay.
And you said it early in our conversation. You said that the Confederacy and, you know, people like Lee got 600,000 Americans killed.
Yes.
I'm not gonna argue the number, whether it's, you know, more or less, but I will argue the fact that if you divide the number between Confederates killed and Americans killed, you wind up with something more like 300,000 Americans killed and 300,000.
Okay. Yeah. Let me clarify. I'm saying that the Confederates caused the war. And as a result of that, you didn't have a Confederacy, you didn't have secession, none of those people would have died.
Right, because to that extent, they would have all still been Americans.
Right, and so I'm blaming the Confederacy and secession. Now, here's the thing. Without the Civil War, I don't think slavery would have ever ended. And so I'm not, you know, in that sense, with the horrible human cost, you have to balance that against the horrible human cost of the slave trade and slavery. But the Confederates ultimately, because they're the rebel force, have to bear responsibility, I feel, for every single Civil War casualty. That was the point I was trying to make.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was good natured on my part. But I see references to 600,000 Americans killed all the time. And it sort of raises my hackles because every, you know, no matter what Civil War battlefield you visit, the ones who died under the Confederate colors did not die Americans. They died Confederates.
Yeah, they were fighting against the U.S. government.
They had renounced their citizenship in order to prosecute the war.
Okay, so I made a mistake of appearing on an AM hate radio show.
Okay, yeah, that was a mistake.
And this caused the host to blow up. But I want people to think about this. So I pointed out the modern estimates, because traditionally they had said 600,000. That's gone up because they've gone back, looked at census records, property deeds, et cetera, et cetera. They now think it's more than 700,000, maybe even close to 750,000 people died. And so I said, the Confederates killed far, far more people than al-Qaeda did on September 11th by, you know, 700,000+ to 3,000. And we don't have statues of Osama bin Laden either. And that really shocks people, but I want people to think about the damage done to the country, you know, the damage done to slaves, their bodies, their families, to the infrastructure of the country, the economic cost of the war, and then the death total. And you can't see this cause, whatever you think about the, you know, the individual soldiers and their motives, the Confederacy itself is a force of evil. And I say that, by the way, as someone whose great-great-grandfather fought in the Confederate Army at the Battle of Shiloh and was a slave owner, but I am not going to embrace that as a point of pride. I mean, if that's all you have to be proud of in your family history, you need to dig deeper.
You got some work to do, absolutely. And I mean, having grown up where I did, I have walked the Shiloh battlefield on a number of occasions, and I'm always just stopped in my tracks for a moment when I see the monuments, the ones that are to the farm boys from Minnesota who walked to riverboats and trains and whatever, all the way to Shiloh, Iowa, Michigan, Ohio. These were frontier states, and these were often young men who maybe weren't even born here, but answered Lincoln's call to preserve the Union. And and that's a degree of patriotism that it'll just about bring you to tears when you sit there looking at it. And you see the same sort of thing at Gettysburg. And to sit there and think that we're going to glorify the people who took up arms against those, it's sickening. It is sickening to me. Let me ask you one more question, and we will quit perhaps for this time. Let me ask you about the most problematic and troublesome Confederate memorial of them all. You are
other than Jeff Sessions, I guess.
Well, okay, yes, him too. Okay. Jefferson Davis Beauregard Sessions the Third. I always throw the Davis in there because that's the Jefferson he's named after, not Tom.
Right.
You get to do as you please. What happens to Stone Mountain, Georgia?
Well. That's going to be in terms, you've got a mountain there, right? You don't want to do damage to a natural site. I'm really focused on the monuments here in Dallas, the other statues. I'm not sure how to resolve that, but I think that you're eventually going to have to chisel that off. This is controversial, but I do find, Mount Rushmore, the fact that they took a sacred Native American site and imposed that on there, that's problematic. Maybe we can live with that. Some admirable people like Lincoln are on that monument. But I think you have to tackle that, and it's going to be painful. But here's the thing. The landscape changes with time. No one was upset when all the Lenin statues and the Stalin statues went down. We reinterpret history. The monuments weren't always there. That Stone Mountain didn't always have that relief there. And we may have to swallow hard and do it and get past it and then create a landscape that really does communicate our values of today, the values we say we believe in. We want to declare to the world that we are not committed still to white supremacy. We're not committed to human bondage, that we actually are striving towards, even though we've never succeeded, to live according to the values that are stated in the Bill of Rights. It's time for our landscape to proclaim that, and there'll be some pain, but certainly, the damage that could happen in the mountain, I think it's part of cleansing the soul of the country.
Well, one of the other things, one of the other hats that I wear is that, because I live in West Virginia, is that of being an opponent of mountaintop removal, in which the coal companies blow up entire mountains. The idea of... It feels a little hypocritical for me to say that, we're opposed to blowing up the mountains here, but let's not. But there's another part of me, and like you, okay, I have ancestors on both sides of the Civil War.
Right.
But I feel no conflict about it, and I feel perfectly comfortable sitting here in the second decade of the 21st century, passing a certain degree of judgment upon them. Because history does that.
Absolutely.
Thucydides was passing judgment, for Christ's sakes.
Sure. I would just say that, with blowing up the tops of mountains to get the coal, they're trying to achieve economy of scale. So this is an engineering problem, but I think it could be accomplished and not create the same kind of damage. We'll have to see.
Right, the anti-Confederate side of me thinks it would be just beautiful, beautiful symbolic irony to take an artillery company made up entirely of the descendants of slaves, African Americans, dress them in Union blue, Only let them bring some really high-powered artillery with them, you know, modern artillery, and just blast the living bejesus out of that statue. I think it would be glorious. And then look at him and say, and you know what? If you raise a finger, we'll burn Atlanta again.
As a historian, I'll just laugh and leave it at that.
I know, I know. I'm being a smart aleck. If they can get so wrought and worked up, on our side, don't we also have a little bit of a right to go? You know, you lost. It's a you're the one who calls it the lost cause. I remember in 2000 when those of us who voted for Al Gore were told quite stentoriously to get over it.
Exactly. Yeah, this is, and that's the thing, because, you know, I've received all the classic right-wing insults. Libtard is one, and snowflake.
Snowflake, I'm saying, absolutely.
Who's the snowflake, really, seriously? I mean, who's so sensitive? They expect African-Americans to walk by statues that honor slave owners, and they mock their wounded feelings from that. But then they're hurt because we're not paying tribute to people who try to destroy the nation. I mean, the real, you know, I don't want to even use the term, but if they were going to use the term, the real snowflakes are the neo-Confederates.
Absolutely. So let me ask you this. Have you taken appropriate measures in the face of the threats that you have received?
I've called the police. I don't feel like I have the slightest right to be scared or nervous or worried about this, because there are people in this country who face mortal danger every time they step outside their houses because of their skin color or because of their orientation or because of their religion. And I am in every single type of, you know, my primary language is English. I'm straight. I'm white. I'm male. I have every privilege this society grants me without any merit. You know, I'm just granted it because of the sexism and the racism and, you know, the homophobia of the society. I don't face the dangers. A black person does, just, you know, carrying Skittles in their neighborhood. And so I'm not,
so
I refuse to be, I refuse to be even slightly intimidated or worried about it. You know, I love my family. I worry about them, but I really don't. These guys are, you know, keyboard warriors. They feel very brave in the basement of their mother's homes as they type these things. And, by the way, we really don't have basements in Texas. That's metaphorical. But anyway, they feel very brave, you know, looking at a computer screen. But I think they're cowards, and I'm not in the least intimidated by these people at all.
I think that's the way to be. Dr. Michael Phillips, I thank you so much for taking time for this conversation. I'm a hopeless history nerd. This particular topic, though, it extends far beyond history. It's current. It's real. And, you know, you talked about all the damage the Civil War did. Look at the damage it's still doing, even as we speak. So
absolutely.
Thank you for making that so obvious. Please stay safe. Most of them are cowards, but they've got a lot of blood on their hands, and they've proven themselves in groups not to be afraid to do grievous harm. So, you know, if nothing else, just be aware of your circumstances. Pay attention. I mean, you're in Texas. So I thank you very kindly, and I hope we'll talk on other topics. I've got a colleague here, Dr. Bill O'Brien, also a PhD in history. His area of focus is the ratification of the Constitution. And if I got you together with him on his program, I have a feeling you two could go at it for two solid hours and leave everybody listening going, no, two more, please. So maybe we'll set that up at some point. All right. Thank you, Dr. Phillips. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
What a conversation. If you ever wondered, hey, Bob, what do you mean by conversation radio? Well, that's what conversation radio means right there. And that is Dr. Michael Phillips from the Greater Dallas area. He is a college professor in Plano. And he, quite bravely, is standing up to the forces of evil okay? The Confederacy was evil, and the people who support the Confederacy, I would submit, are perpetuating that evil. And he is very bravely standing up against them in a place where doing so takes a significant amount of courage. Like I've said before, progressive people behind the cornbread curtain are some of the bravest people you will ever meet in your life. It's 15 minutes past the hour. I didn't go through the usual litany at the beginning of the program, but let me, prayer meeting Wednesday, litany, get it? See what I did there? Let me note a couple of thank yous. Thank you to Catherine, and thank you to brand new subscriber, Stacy, in Pennsylvania. Because of them and because of the overnight, the subscribers overnight, namely our buddy Philip in Maryland, and Joyce in Washington, and Brenda, yeah, also in Washington. What was a rather harrowing fundraising goal for the evening has significantly diminished. And so I can tell you here at 16 minutes past the hour that in the remainder of the program, we need only raise $273, which is only $73 more than the ordinary fundraising goal for any given evening. So I'm not going to sit here and do the math, but I'll say $273. I also did some more math earlier today. You know, we're trying very hard to achieve this goal of 400 $10 a month subscribers. And right now we're at about 337. Well, at 10 bucks a month, I figured out that on a per night basis, a $10 a month subscriber contributes less than the cost of an ounce of bottled water for every hour of programming delivered. A whole three-hour program for a $10 a month subscriber isn't even the same amount as a bottle of water. And I'm not even talking about the really highfalutin fancy water like the stuff they get off of the glaciers and melt down and shoot the glaciers with 30-06s. No. I'm just talking about your standard $2 bottle of water. That's amazing to me. Thank you so very much for all the kind words, Carol, about the previous conversation. Carol said that was fantastic. You were both great. I love a good, engaged conversation. Makes it all worthwhile. Scott just said, brilliant interview with Dr. Phillips and the current neo-Confederate movement being equated with Holocaust denial is absolutely spot on. Thanks. That these folks, even today, believe that programs intended to allow minorities a hand up are somehow unfair or a reverse discrimination is absurd. The part that they miss, usually deliberately, is that the sole intention of those programs was simply to even up things at what amounts to a track meet. To undo them would be not unlike declaring one starting point for everyone else while requiring the minority participants in the race to start things lashed to a chair with their track shoes laces knotted together from a venue in a neighboring town. And that's exactly it. And this is, you know, this is an issue, as Dr. Phillips pointed out, Michael, that's gonna be with us for a little while. But it's one of those things, you know, when you've got a boil, the best thing to do is to deal with it soon and not sit around and let it fester and spread. And we're already, to a certain extent, for the last 150 years or so, in the fester and spread stage. It's time to lance the little bastard. There are multiple examples of it. There was a court decision today, And rather rather telling it was. Because among a court in Arizona, a federal judge in Arizona, ruled on a lawsuit filed when the state of Arizona passed its attempt to suppress the history of the Mexican influence on the state history of Arizona. And the judge today ruled that that suppression was, in fact, improper. It was brought by someone who said that that Mexican-American studies in a high school promoted anti-white hate. Indeed, who are the snowflakes? But that federal judge ruled today that no. There was racial bias in the legislation suppressing the study, and that it had to go. Case isn't over. The judge still has to issue a ruling as to what the remedy is. But it is it's a step in the right direction. So we have that. It's 21 minutes past the hour. I'll go ahead and open up the phone lines. If you want to engage in conversation, you're welcome to. The number, of course, 304-574-8178, or Skype to Skype from anywhere in the world, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. It is prayer meeting Wednesday, but like I said, we've kind of dispensed with all of that. Some of you will be upset, some of you won't. The topic for me, the topic at the height of the conversation has to be the madness that we saw last night, again, in Arizona. I've seen a whole lot of Trump rallies. I had thought until last night that I was pretty well inured to them, that I was immunized against the manifestations of Trumpansy hate, Trumpansy ignorance, Trumpansy grievance. But anyone who watches my Facebook or Twitter feed knows that I was pretty well shaken up last night. I watched that whole 77 minutes. I almost tweeted, and then I deleted it because I couldn't get the words quite right. But that speech last night reminded me of nothing so much as the stem winders that Fidel Castro used to give for years on end. And then lo and behold, I read Charlie Pierce this afternoon and I see him saying the same thing. So yeah, I don't, because it was, I would dare say Fidel Castro, I'm not a speaker of Spanish, but you know, I've seen translations and whatnot. I dare say Fidel Castro was by far more coherent in his long-winded speechifying. Last night was nothing more and nothing less than a dementia patient who got away from the people who are charged with his with seeing to his well-being, and went out and started screaming his perceived and imaginary grievances to whomever would listen. He talked about how full the venue was, when in point of fact, the venue was near empty. They had to screen off more than half of the arena and cram all the little Trumpansies into a limited space in order to make it like the hall look like the hall was full at all. If they hadn't done that, it would have been more room than people. I'm sure this was, of course, at the insistence of the president. He went on and on and on about how few protesters there were outside the venue. There were, in fact, over 1,000. He ranted and raved in true, and look, this I'm not you know, only Hitler is Hitler, okay? But he ranted and raved about the media in true Hitlerian fashion. Or perhaps it would be less inflammatory to say in true fascist fashion, because Hitler wasn't the only one who did that sort of thing. And at one point I tweeted, it looks like Festivus came early for Trump tonight, because here we have the airing of grievances. There were no feats of strength. If you watched, and I know a, based on the response that I got from various people on social media, a lot of people didn't watch it. A lot of people can't stand to. I generally can't. But given the fact that the mayor of Phoenix had begged Trump not to come, given the fact that the governor of Arizona refused to take the stage with him, given the fact that neither of the of Arizona's senators, both John McCain and Jeff Flake, were willing to be seen within a country mile of him, given the fact that he was left to resort to, it is prayer meeting Wednesday after all, that nasty ass grifter Franklin Graham, and a woman we've talked about here in the past, whom we refer to as Velveeta King, she's the shameful member of the King family. She is the niece of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and she's a fetus fetishist. And then, in what appears to have possibly been a breach of the law, Ben Grain Silos Carson showed up to harangue the crowd a little bit. Now, he's a sitting member of the cabinet, and this was clearly designated a campaign rally. This wasn't Donald Trump showing up in his capacity as president. It was Donald Trump showing up in his capacity as candidate for president in 2020. And Ben Carson still said, well, sure, I guess I can come along. You know, mumbling Ben. And it was bizarre as hell. Carol points out, Lawrence O'Donnell was pretty brilliant last night. I think the word liar was used more times than I could count. Well, you know, because there were more lies than could readily be counted. And so, you know, we had the report earlier in the day of that phone call between chinless Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump, in which Donald Trump swore at him and screamed at him, and at which point chinless Mitch McConnell apparently volleyed in kind, swearing and screaming at Geezer Disgustus. Kind of hard to know who to root for there. Kind of hard to root for either side. I mean, it's kind of like, I don't know. For me, shoot. What would this be? It would be like watching Notre Dame play Pitt. You don't know who you want to see lose. So, and it was all there. He had the Trump had the maggots who were there. He had them ready to go and kill them, some journalists. It's a miracle such as they are, that they didn't go and kill them, a journalist, because he wanted to, or to have somebody do his dirty work for him. I don't know how you could be Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan and sit there and say, well, you know, at least he's a Republican, and not move affirmatively to begin the process that would take him out of office, even if what you get afterward is Mike Pence. So it's a tough call. And then there was the clean coal thing. And you know what that phrase does to me. I had a conversation with Brad Friedman for his program this evening. And yeah, that phrase, clean coal, it just goes through me like a dose of salts. Steve in New York says, Trump last night, I just can't watch him. However, I'm thinking I should watch for its sociological and cautionary value. I really would. It's not easy. It is 77 minutes of pure, unmitigated madness. But I think almost as an act of patriotic duty, we kind of have to watch this thing. This was, it really was. It was unlike any before. He stood there and reread his statements about Charlottesville, saying, "In the lying media, the dishonest fake media, they said I wasn't fast enough." All the while leaving out the line he said about, "Oh, there were some nice knots. There were good people on both sides there." Yeah. If you want to talk about that, we can. So let's run over and here halfway into the program. Now that let's check in with Todd down in South Carolina, Stan. Hey, Todd.
Bob, what's going on? How you doing?
It's been a weird day all day long. I mean, I watched that last night, Agnes. I looked at Agnes and I said, I'm not okay.
No, you shouldn't be.
And then I got up this morning and you know, I don't drink. And I got up this morning and I felt like I'd been on a bender of really, really, really bad liquor. You know, the one where you just can't quite shake the fog and you just, your stomach's kind of ugh. And it's like you're out of sync with time and space itself. You know that?
That, like, how did I get here? That kind of that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I'm glad you were able to take my call, honestly. That's a great, I'm just really happy because I was shocked. You know, people on your program have been talking about this inability to discharge duties for over a year, probably, for quite a while. But after that fiasco, after that, you know what? After that Waterloo, that was his Waterloo.
I'm proud of you for going to Waterloo instead of clusterfuck. I just am.
Oh, I'm just getting started. I'm gonna be nice. I have no control. What I'm saying, I'm gonna try not to curse right now because it's too fucking serious.
I understand.
Yeah. I mean, literally, I just said that because it was like the Waterloo thing just popped in my head because he was totally, that was all him. And now everybody, all of the things we've been saying for all this time, now all of a sudden people are like, oh, 25th Amendment. Oh, he's not fit. Oh, it's like, well, where were you like 8 months ago? You know, so there's so much here. Because this is where I want to start. I want to start at the beginning, and it's not going to take long, seriously. But remember the second debate when he started talking about suppressing the media and the press, right? That perked my ears up. I didn't like the way that sounded. Nobody did. Nobody thinking. Conscious, you know, people like us, we didn't like that.
I mean, so, he is, and Eugene Robinson, the day before, even before this happened, you know, Eugene Robinson of the Washington Post had written a column saying, it is time to question the mental stability of Donald Trump.
It's all over now. It's just like the floodgate has opened. That was what I'm saying. That's why when I said Waterloo, you know, it's not the best analogy to think of just in the past like 5 minutes. It just popped in my head only because Napoleon was strong for a minute and then, you know, he just got beat down. And maybe I should be quiet. But what I'm trying to say is that this, in other words, everything, he has no allies now. His allies have been burned up. That was his Waterloo.
Well, I mean, he's still got Franklin Graham and Velveeta King and Ben Carson, apparently.
Well, let me tell you something about Mr. Graham. I was so disappointed because after the callers in on my morning program, my morning program. So he was on there. They interviewed him for quite a while. So, you know, he got to open up because he got a lot of people who were sycophants of him and were asking him questions. So he really opened up, and I was like, this motherfucker's out of his goddamn mind. Had to be that young and be a fucking throwback, a troglodyte. His father wasn't that fucked up. This guy needs to go somewhere, man.
Oh, and by the way, as far as the audience is concerned, I don't know if you noticed this or not, but the people that they're putting behind him now are beginning to recycle. There were a pair of women behind him last night that were in the crowd in Huntington, West Virginia, too. Unmistakable.
No, I noticed that.
And then there was the Blacks for Trump guy. And what a story he has.
See, Bob, we are on the same page with this. This is what I'm saying. All right, this is what I fucking want to get out of. I gotta get this out. See. Why has the press been so slow? He started off with this kind of Hitler Mussolini type persona with the hand gestures and everything. Then it was with the speech, and I was like, you know what? This doesn't look right. This was a year and a half. I mean, a long time ago, probably before that, because with the birther stuff. He was always racist, but I'm talking about perfecting this shit and presenting this to our dumbed down masses at the right time, because that should have been an obvious gift. This is like we've seen this story before. And now that people get, don't be afraid to say he's like Hitler. Don't be afraid to say fascist, because if it is, it is. I mean, it's simple. Fascism, emergence of capital and the government. I mean, that's in like one sentence. It's much more complicated than that, but that's basically what it is. And look at these fucking people he put in there, stealing shit left and right, including himself. And just thinking nothing's going to happen. That's how you started, talking about the press, because everybody knew. Everybody in Northeast knew he was a crook and a weirdo and a crazy person and a racist.
Do you think we did I'd have to go back and check the archives. Did we know he was this nuts? Because, I mean, last night, it's like, I mean, I I'm almost rendered speechless. I've been talking about how bad he is for a very long time. We've talked about how erratic he is, how stupid he is, because he's... I mean, at one point last night, I don't know if you caught it, but and I'm smarter than everybody, and I went to the best schools, and I made the best grades. I made better grades than anybody, than any of these elite journalists who went to these elite schools. And, you know, goddamn, you're the birther bastard. You're the guy who said release the birth certificate. Release your fucking transcript, dipshit.
See, Bob, I'm telling you, this was, he knows, I'm telling you, the screws are on. See, this is what's happening to him now. That was his last, he's like, he's a downtrodden white dude. Every day, beat me up. I tried to stick up for you guys. That was great white hope, but they beat me down, and now they got me, because he's going to have to fucking resign. They're going to give him a deal. We saw this coming. I mean, and he doesn't want to, but that's what he's speaking out, so he still has something to hold on to, that audience, you know, that even then they were like, it wasn't like the old ones. But and like you said, too, I noticed that about the rotating. He likes, like I heard you say one day, and that's the truth. He got, like you know, and that's TV. That's Goebbels, whoever the propaganda guy was or not. They always made sure they had the flags around, the poles just right. He got some good-looking women in the background. You know, he had the good-looking blonde women. And that's the people who he's, you know, trying to court. You know,
yeah, Matt in San Francisco just described them as the Blanche Devereaux twins behind Trump last night. Yeah, they both had MAGA hats on. They both were ladies of a certain age, and they both had makeup on, put on with either a roller or a trowel, and, you know, were not dressed age appropriately or whatever. Okay, I'm being sexist. I'm being an asshole. I apologize. But, I mean.
But that's what they were there for, eye candy. You know, like Fox News. It's Fox News, except it's his rally. And when, like you brought up, see, he cannot get away from the grip and the grasp. Like you were talking about Sleepy Ben. Now, we hadn't heard a peep out of him, and now he shows up when it's totally financially inappropriate.
Ethically inappropriate. But the point I was trying to get at, Todd, is this. I don't know if in describing him in the past, I don't recall, how can I put this? I reached the conclusion last night that our country is in grave goddamn danger, okay? Before, okay. It was like, you know, we've got a guy who's unstable, we've got a guy who's a mess, we've got a guy who is a crook, a grifter, a lowlife, a dirtbag, a scumbag, a guy who wants to commit incest with his daughter.
Wow.
You know, we've got all that. But last night, it felt different, Todd. Last night, it felt like we are in the clutches of a man who would as soon destroy this country as, he'd destroy this country before he'd let himself be destroyed. He'll take the country with him.
He would rather destroy the country before the country finds out his real deep secrets that he does not want people to know.
And, He's not okay.
He's not okay. It was greasy feeling. It was just like, wow, this guy, you know.
There were aspects of it that were like watching WWE, where he'd make a point and then he'd put his arms out and pump them to the side and he'd turn around and look at those people behind him and he'd, you know, the same way a professional wrestler does after he's like cheap shot at his opponent. And the, right. The opponents, and the only thing it was lacking was the part where the cheap shotted opponent gets up and hits the bad guy with a chair.
Turning
his back on the audience thing, and gesturing toward himself. I mean, if he's allowed to go much further, he will eventually flip out his dick.
You don't give him any. Nobody who can see it. Mushroom cat, come on.
Yeah, Carol Baker said, Trump denies he's mentally ill. Don't take my word for it. Ask my good friend here, Napoleon Bonaparte. Hey, Nappy, do I look nuts to you? He's not okay. Yeah. I've taken the program into the gutter. I just got from Sailor Chick in the chat room. I just got an "Oh Bob" in all caps. Maybe I should. You know, I need to make a recording of Agnes. She does a really, really good Laura Petrie from the Dick Van Dyke Show. Going, "Oh Bob," I need to just record that for those moments.
Oh, wait a minute. The gutter has been reassigned. Look at the president. Everything. The metric is off. All right? The metric is different. This is like when you used to go to school. Oh, you could be like the president. I can grab pussy, and I can lie and cheat and steal. Oh, Lord, I love it. I want to be president.
Yeah, I got a note here from Scott saying, compared to Trump in Phoenix last night, General Jack D. Ripper in Dr. Strangelove seems well-adjusted. So we need now Jack's little cool water on the back of the neck and the code. Cool water on the back of the neck ain't going to help him. This country, I mean, I know I've been saying it for a long time. People are probably tired of it. While the rest of it,
if Trump does this and if Trump does that, we may find ourselves possibly in a constitutional crisis.
And I'm the one who was saying all along, no, goddammit, we're in one right now, thank you. We are.
What about the people, Bob?
There's
too many people following him. That's the problem.
That's the point of the last two nights, Jane Goodall among the Trumpanzees anthropology segments.
Oh, from South Philly? Well, she's either from South Philly or Northeast Philadelphia.
Last night we had the panel, including the black lady, who says of North Korea, kaboom!
That's right. But we're in a bad place. People watch too much TV.
But the thing is, and this is where the lack of principles of the Republican Party comes in, Todd. The Republican Party had the opportunity at the beginning of the primary process to just refuse to allow him to be a candidate, to disavow him, tell him, if you're going to run, you're going to run as an independent. You're not going to run as a Republican. But from that moment to this, as if we needed any confirmation, we learned that the Republican Party has no principles, okay? And so, yeah, they let him run. They thought it'd be good exposure for the Republican Party generally. It'll draw eyeballs to the screens for the debates, blah blah blah. It'll be great with fundraising, yada yada. We'll take care of him later. One of these real pros will knock him out, but it'll be a great show while it's going on.
Right.
And so they wind up with him as president, and now they've got him as president.
Right.
And they also know that they have around 33% of the people who vote in this country who will go and vote for him again.
Again, with guns.
And who will do what they are told. So that means if you've got 33% locked down, what do you have to do? All you have to do is find another 17% among the people that you're going to tell, whoever the Democratic nominee is in 20, you're going to tell them that that person is the most liberal candidate since Hillary Clinton. Hey! And boom, second term.
There's two things going on here. More than two, but two things. All right, first of all, what you're saying is absolutely, I totally agree with. And, that once you have, they've got that concrete base, no matter what he does, they are with him. I hear these people every morning, or whenever I choose to hear it, on Washington Journal, and they're serious, and they vote. Most of them vote. Most of them vote because they're motivated. So, they're going to build on that. But it's like too many people aren't paying attention. So in that speech, he said, all right, we have to stop these Democratic obstructionists. But they own they are running every part, every branch of our government that can push any legislation forward. They own it. They run it. They make the rules. They make the fucking rules. I don't think a lot of people understand. In the House where the money comes from, they can fucking make it. They can come in one day and say, you know what? We're going to, this is it. Yeah, they talked about it last night's dinner. We're going to change this rule. They can fucking change rules like that. Am I lying, Bob?
No, it's not from one day to the next, but they set their rules at the beginning of every new Congress.
They do at the beginning of the session.
Him sitting there and pontificating against the filibuster. It just goes to show the extent to which he does not understand the legislative process, even one itsy bitsy little bit. He doesn't care if the Democrats ever have a majority again. because, well, he, what do you suppose the Democrats would do with no filibuster?
And we're too decent as a group.
You know, McConnell is at least at present disinclined to do it, because McConnell knows there's going to come a day. See, McConnell does. He's evil, but he's evilly intelligent. Okay. He's looking at an electoral map in 2018 that where he's only got to hang on to 8 or 9 seats to hang on to his. He's only got to hang on to like 6 out of those, or 7 out of those to keep his majority, and the odds of even losing 2 of them are extremely narrow. But guess what? It changes completely in 2020, and he's got to preserve 20-some-odd seats.
Well,
he's not in a hurry to upset the apple cart right now. And I suspect he knows at this point, having been on the receiving end of Tangerine Tiberius's insane outrage, he knows the country's not okay. Maybe he better than anybody knows what danger this country is in.
And see, I think it's like an analogy with the an iceberg, because we have net finally, like we've been talking about this like for ad nauseum, but now it's out in the sphere. The talking heads are talking about it. Now we have documented legislators, federal legislators, congressmen and representatives on record saying they will make moves if necessary. See, but that's the tip of the iceberg. That was what I'm trying to get to. There's a lot going on underneath.
Yeah, I had a note from Steve a minute ago, and you can tell me. Steve says, my big worry is that if he resigns or the Congress impeaches him and removes him, there will be blood and riots, Charlottesville to the 10th power. And I understand what Steve's getting at there, Todd, but, there's an old line from Shakespeare. If 'twere done, 'twere best done quickly. Okay. Waiting is not going to help. The best thing to have done would have been for the Republican Party to have put country ahead of everything else. And it's not like they wouldn't have had a viable candidate. Okay? Jeb Bush, John Kasich, little Marco, any of those. Lindsey Graham was running, for heaven's sakes. They would have all been fine. They would have all been fine Republican nominees. The best thing, looking back, would have been for the Republican Party to have moved affirmatively to stop the Donald Trump candidacy before it got started. To stop this raving horde of maniacs before they could get any wind in their sails. That would have been the best thing. But we don't have a wayback machine. We are where we are. And it's not going to get any better, okay? That 33% is not going to turn into 31 or 30 or 29 or 24.
No, they're there. They might be. They have roots. They've always been there.
They are a hard, cancerous knot of dead enders and hard cases who want an America that they can't even define, except to say that they want it to be an America that doesn't have any people of color particularly visible in it. My God, he stood there in front of them last night, Todd, and said he was mad at Congress because they wouldn't pay for the wall when the son of a bitch said that the wall was going to be paid for by Mexico. And the maggots don't even have the intellectual capacity to say, wait a minute, he said it was going to be paid for by Mexico. Well, it's all right. He's Trump. We can pay for it. That's all right. God damn!
You pass out some clubs, jugs of whiskey, and some cheese sandwiches, and that they could do in a whole town. Those people, man, Exactly. They're not thinking. How can Democrats be obstructionists? We don't. We're not. We have no majority anywhere right now. All we can do is talk a lot.
And on top of it all, and he thought he was being cute. He thought he was being clever by saying, "Well, I'm not going to say the guy's name, but you know, one senator kept us from being able to give you great health care."
Mm-hmm.
One senator, and I'm not going to say his name, but I don't think much of Jeff Flake either. Ooh, one senator. Yeah, I mean, look. I've given my fair share of hell to John McCain, and he's earned every goddamn bit of it. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, apparently nobody ever told Donald Trump Reagan's 11th commandment, and Reagan's 11th commandment has served that party well. Thou shalt not criticize a fellow Republican.
Right. Yeah. He got them in lockstep. And I heard what you said. I totally agree the other night what you said. Maybe, I don't know what night it was, but that's what most people who like history, American history, the South is a big block now. This is a powerful, and it always has been, a political block.
Yeah. Well, it was powerful. It was powerful enough in the 19th century to absolutely suppress any discussion of slavery whatsoever. That was a rule in the House of Representatives.
That was a moot point. That wasn't even coming up. Forget about it. That wasn't even coming up. They weren't talking about that.
I mean, one of the people who got got muzzled was a former president of the United States, John Quincy Adams. He's the only president that ever turned around and went back to the legislature. And he tried to bring up a slavery bill. And they used that rule to shut him down.
Oh, okay. Since we've mentioned slavery like 3 or 4 times in the past minute, there's something I want to say. And, you know, I've been around. I've had some friends, white dudes from the South that are my friends that have been business partners. Matter of fact, one of them is all in for his people who are into that Daughters of the Confederacy and all that. But, I mean, we're really, when I say good friends, like Sunday dinner, like for years, every Sunday we had dinner together, every Sunday. But it's hard. How do you tell somebody that I'm sorry, but you know, your folks, well.
Look.
That's not
yeah, I mean, look, I've sat here, I've told people before. I've got a photograph of my grandfather in a group of people in 1922. And I don't know which one he is, because they're all wearing white robes and white hoods.
Damn.
And they're gathered around a burning cross.
Really?
About, 20 miles from here. And you know what? I never met the man. He died just shortly before I was born. My mother used to tell me, he would have loved you. And he was apparently a lovable guy when he wasn't on the sauce. But at 1922, he was 28 years old. And he was a member of the resurgent Klan of the 1920s. But I don't mind condemning him, condemning his membership in the Klan. If you can't do that, even if it's one of your sainted ancestors, there is something morally wrong.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. These people act like you can't talk about their grandfather or what their great grandfather did, and they forget what's patently obvious is that first of all they were traitors, and then they were killing other people. Our countrymen, you know, they went to West Point. West Point's in New York. Well, we were all on the same team. And they still lie about it.
Because money never disappears. Well, I'm having internet problems. At least I still have remained connected to you.
No.
Yeah, I'm not happy. But... You know,
is it raining tonight?
There's a cloud.
I mean, I'm not trying to be funny. I heard what you said before.
No, no. I mean, no, you know, right. Frontier so sucks for air. There's no getting around it.
Well, I'm putting something in the can tonight after we get off. Because you know, every little bit helps. Do my part tonight. But that speech was really disturbing because it just seemed like. And I heard a woman call in today in Washington Journal, and she said exactly kind of what I was thinking. He sounded a lot like Archie Bunker at the bar late at night at the end, just talking shit.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, we'll save some of this conversation. I got a little addled here because I'm trying to get everything reconnected. I got everything reconnected. We will... We will take the conversation further soon. By the way, I had a kick-ass rack of ribs on the Acorn, and I was surprised. I did a pork loin.
Oh,
and you know it's real easy to fuck up a pork loin on a smoker because they will dry out fast. This thing, I didn't even wrap it in foil.
You didn't wrap it?
No. I'm experimenting, and I stuck.
Wait a minute. You didn't wrap this thing. Okay.
No.
Okay. Wait, was it dry rubbed or was it wet?
I dry rubbed it.
Okay.
Used a real hot spicy dry rub of my own invention. Got the fire just right, 225 degrees. Put the probe in, shut it, locked it down, let that sucker get up to 155. Let it rest for 15 minutes. It crossed 160, and it was pure porcine juiciness. Mm. That Todd, you gotta own one of these things.
I gotta get one.
It's working great. I gotta tell you, since you know you're the official the grilling and barbecue correspondent. I've seen another grill that I've got the hots for.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a long time ever getting my hands on one of these unless I can, you know, swap them out one for, you know, mentions. It's called the Kudu Braai. And it's based on a South African concept of everybody sitting around and cooking food over an open flame. They call it like the African TV because everybody just looks at the fire. But it's got a charcoal pan, and then it's got three pans on steel posts above it that can go up and down and then swing out horizontally to the point that it's even off the fire.
Oh, man. You can have different courses cooking at the same time. Wow.
Yeah, you can, and there's, you know, they've got accessories. They've always got accessories. There's one accessory you can use as a deep fryer and bread pan. And one of the grills has, you know, perforations, slots. Another one of the grills is just solid. And then the bottom grill where the coals are, you can just stick a Dutch oven down into that and like bake cobbler. While you've got steaks going on up above it, chops or whatever, fish.
And you know they're made in
Macon, Georgia. And again, it's called the Kudu KUDUBRAII. And they're $800 bucks. That ain't happening.
But it's passing off of that South African, and you know that weather down there in South Africa is like. I guess Southern California, Northern Mexico, where it's warm in the day and it's cold at night. That's why you see those people walking around with knit hats on. Like,
yeah.
Why
you know? Well, you know, I mean, because they're, you know, south, it gets cold south too. You know, once you're below, the further south you go below the equator, the colder it gets, you know, Antarctica and all that shit. And I haven't done brisket yet. They've got an untreated, untrimmed whole brisket sitting up at the Wiggling Pig. For $44.
Is that good?
Oh, well, no, it's not. I mean, it's a decent price, but you're paying for a whole lot of fat in that.
That's what I was thinking. I don't know. Meat is funny. Meat is so funny. Meat is so funny. I don't know, man. I'm really, like, funny about my meat, man. It's like, you could even go to the same place, but I get really, and you have to poke it, you got to feel it, because I don't know, I guess because it was alive.
Well, it depends on where it comes from. Like, a standing rib roast from the loin end is better than a standing rib roast from the other end. It's just mm-hmm. more tender. And I still haven't done steaks or anything on the acorn, because...
Can I ask you this? So when I saw it, the last time I saw it in the store, right, and then I didn't even know you had one at that point, but it had this, like, hanger on it for, like, dripping gravy or fat or something. It was, like, chrome, and it had this little hanger. There were all these little attachments that went on the edges, you know?
I don't know quite what you're talking about. I mean, it comes with a little thing that you can hang on the side, that you use to.
Maybe that's what I thought.
It's a hook that you use to pull up the blazing hot grill with.
Well, see, I think they improved on the egg. I think they looked at the egg and they made some improvements, because I was messing with it. You know, I have to touch everything when I go in there. I'm like up and down with the lid, you know.
Now, but now, see, here's the other thing. For people who have, like, limited space and stuff, they make a mini acorn, or an acorn mini. And that thing's like 140.
No way.
Yeah, it's $140. It's big enough that you could drop a pork butt on it. Or, you know, you could cut a whole rack of, like, St. Louis-style ribs in half and prop them on a rib rack inside of it. And, you know, you still get the same heat. The principles are the same. It's just... miniaturized.
You know what? Fall is coming up. We're about to have some serious barbecue conversation.
It's time. It's time. Mountaineer season's coming on. The reason I mentioned the brisket is I haven't done a brisket yet, and I got to see how this thing handles a brisket.
Now, how do you taste it? How much can you handle?
What do you mean? To eat it?
Yeah.
I have to be judicious. You know, I can't just sit there and go wild. But, you know, I'm sort of eating again. You know, I'm still eating a lot of yogurt. But I'm not eating crap.
Man,
when I do something on the grill, you know, on the ribs, oh my God. You know, no sauce, no slop, no mop, none of that. You know, about 3 hours. And the meat has pulled back off the bone, and it doesn't fall off the bone. You got to chew it off the bone, but it's tender and juicy and wonderful. Oh, yeah.
You know what? I think I believe that. Yo, that is beautiful. And you know, it's nothing like having some good, like you said, when you can have no sauce on it.
Yeah, but if the neighbors are going to get anywhere near you, that mini will not cut the mustard.
Well, yeah, that gets tricky.
And I still, and
wait a minute, let me tell you something funny. Do you know that one morning I went out one morning and the grill was still on, and I'm wiping my eyes, you know, wash my face, you know, we'll wash up. I go out, the grill's still hot. I'm like, oh, all right, so I have some more meat. So I go throw some meat on the grill, and the garbage man comes because we have backyard pickup, and he's like, "Oh, make me a plate."
it happens. I've had people. I used to have the smoker out in the front yard, and the depending on which way the wind was blowing, the smoke would blow out toward the road, and I had people turning in and pulling up in my driveway and asking me how much for a slab.
You know, and it's funny. You don't know how to respond. But,
well, I said, you know, I'm sorry, it's not for sale. But they said, "Damn, it smells so good."
I'm telling you, that low smoke, when it's moist out, it's all humid, and nice, thick, sweet smoke lingers close to the ground.
Yeah, and I got to teach Ferg a little bit about charcoal usage, because while Agnes and I were gone, he decided to, like, you know, just grill some weenies for him and his buddy to have hot dogs.
Uh-huh.
this last, you know, with the pork loin and the rack of ribs, I didn't have to use any more charcoal. I just scooped out what was left because he'd used like half a bag. And that thing is so, that thing is so efficient that, you know.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's why I was calling that for a while. I don't know why, where I got it from. I was like calling that design like the Genghis Khan type of thing because it's really kind of Asian in a way because, like, you look at a wok.
Oh, it is. It is Asian. Those things were brought back over as a result of our warfare in Asia.
That's just the way I saw it.
They're ceramic ovens, and what the char griller people did is they worked around the ceramic concept. They used some more modern, you know, stuff. It's not nearly as heavy, and it's not nearly as fragile.
But that cone, see, it's when you got that egg shape, it doesn't take much fuel at the bottom, and it keeps it hot, and it even
right. And you can and once you figured out how, you can maintain temperature with real precision. And then, like I said, if you want to get hyper nerdy, there's a thing that costs more than the grill does, and it fits down on the top manifold, and it's a computer controlled fan, and it will and it's battery operated. And it will keep the heat inside the unit at a precision set temperature.
Wow!
But they're like $300, and you know, that feels like cheating to me, Todd.
Well, you know what? That's if you have a small restaurant and you got a pop up beer garden next to you, and you got that in the back, and like maybe on every other Friday you're doing something like that.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I'm so hungry now.
Yeah, weekend's coming. And, yes, the Kaneka works great on it. Doesn't take any time at all. Hickory smoke on top of hickory smoke.
That Kaneka can't be. That is real sausage. That you can't go to the butcher and get any better sausage than that. It's sausage in a case. It's heavy. It's full of meat. It's real. It's like you would make it if you could make it.
Yeah.
If you like food.
And
people don't like food. You know.
Yeah. Some people are just fueling the machine, and I understand that. Well, Todd, you have yourself a good night, my friend.
Hey, you too. All right, my friend. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye now. Our buddy Todd calling from South Carolina. Stan, one of these days, Todd and I got to get together and barbecue. Just got to get together and barbecue. I think it would be for the ages. A quick update as far as fundraising goes. We like I said, we got it down to $273, and we're still at $273. So hopefully it will not stay that way. It would be very helpful if we didn't, you know, maybe at least get, knock out that $73 so that there won't be, so that tomorrow it'll just be tonight's fundraising and tomorrow's fundraising. I'm not kidding. There are bills to pay. So hopefully, you know, hopefully we'll knock that down. Under the subject line, immature bully, Clarence writes in, Bob, I remember junior high school in Philadelphia. There was always a guy in class who had a lot of mouth. Trump acts just like a 13-year-old. I believe he's trapped in a loop of adolescence. Groundhog Day comes to mind. This guy needs help. Well, if nothing else, he needs maintenance. At 71, 72 years old, he may very well be past help. Especially if it's some organic process like organic brain syndrome or neurosyphilis, Alzheimer's, dementia. Anybody who's had a loved one go through that knows that there's not a lot of coming back from it. But even someone as awful as he is deserves at least palliative care. And he is gone. One of the things, you know, my dirty little habit, I got up this morning, and I think I tweeted something last night,
than I expected to turn on the TV this morning and see Joe Scarborough having purple polka-dotted kittens with crocheted tails, and I wasn't far off. Joe should have been listening to the Monday and Tuesday editions of The Horn this week when we had, Jane Goodall among the Trumpanzees. He might have understood a little more, and he might not have felt quite so compelled to ask this question.
Now let's say, who talks like that? But here's another question. Who cheers at that? Who cheers when a man speaks derisively about an American war hero who has given his life to the people of Arizona and to the United States of America and did so in a POW camp, is battling brain cancer, is going through chemotherapy, and not only are they derisively going along with Donald Trump's, but people are actually shouting that they want John McCain to die. Now, John McCain's a tough guy. He can. Guy.
Oh, that's weird, but you get the gist of the situation. Joe Scarborough, Republican, does not understand who the hardcore cancerous knot of dead enders and hard cases are who remain eternally devoted to Trump. He doesn't understand. Of course, there's that old line about there are none so blind as those who will not see. And he can't see that the same people who are irretrievably attached to Trump are the same people who were running to the polls in 1994 to vote in Newt Gingrich's Contract on America. Joe Scarborough is unable to see that he's part of the reason Donald Trump is here. The entire Republican Party is the reason Donald Trump is here. There was a time in this country when there was no way a Donald Trump could get elected president. But because party matters to the Republicans, ideology matters more to the Republicans than the country itself does, well, they're the one that started the metronome ticking and talking that eventually led to the madness many of us witnessed last night. And it is discomforting in the extreme. Okay, let's run over and check in with Jim. Hey, Jim.
Good evening, sir. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. How about you?
Me too. All you can do.
Did you watch that thing last night?
I couldn't. I caught bits and pieces of it. There was something else I wanted to watch, and I knew what it would be. It would be another type of Trump Nazi rally is all it was. All those people shelling. What were they yelling? I can't even remember the cry.
It depends on which part.
Oh, there were so many repeat things. They were going, Uja. You know, they weren't saying lock her up, lock her up, lock her up. They were saying something else. I don't know what the hell it was. I couldn't stand to watch it. I just couldn't.
Well, if you're feeling anthropological, you might find it and watch it because, Jim, it really was. It was different from anything we've seen before.
What were they saying?
It was everything. It wasn't so. It was him. I mean, it was just. I mean, we've all seen him sit there and rant and rave as recently as you know. He was further gone, Jim, and maybe this is the best metric. He was further gone than he was at the Boy Scout camp or in Huntington.
I caught part of that, and I thought to myself, even Adolf fucking Hitler was a better speaker than this asshole.
Well, no, that's the thing. This is the bunker. This is him raving in the bunker, okay? I mean, when he started raving about how the press didn't appreciate him and how he was so much smarter
than everybody. I mean, this is that scene that everybody made such so many different versions of in that German film with the brilliant portrayal of The Last Days, Downfall. You've seen it.
I have it here. Yeah, I've seen it.
Well, absolutely. You know the one where he reaches up and with shaking hands takes off his glasses after he's been told about Steiner?
Yep, and no attack on Berlin. It was simply in his imagination.
And then he began, and he runs everybody out of the room and proceeds to just begin ranting and raving. That was last night, Jim. Only he did it on national television, and he did it in front of millions of people.
He did.
I mean, he was at a point, there are so many parts of this that you could talk about. There were parts where he said, oh, look, the red lights are going off on the cameras. Dishonest fake news CNN doesn't want to see me tell the truth to the American people. The lights are going off. The lights are going off. Oh, the dishonest media won't carry this anymore.
Bob, what did I say to you a couple nights ago about the Nero order and this man's ability, since he has complete access to all the nuclear codes and can bypass any chain of command? And boom, because of because of a submarine launched ballistic missile off our coast, that he has to, you know, it's called launch and warning. And if he should get any type of bizarre thing from his EWO, then that's the guy who sits outside his bedroom with a football, that he would probably hit all those buttons and enter those codes. I can guarantee you he would. He is just nuts.
And that's the whole point. I'm beyond just pointing out that he's nuts, Jim. Our country is in grave peril.
You know, I emailed you today. You've got those people who support him, and you've got these people who are all upset because of their Confederate statues being torn down. Okay. And I referred to you in my email what the Germans put up in Berlin when it was being completely destroyed. And what they said was, you may break our hearts, but not our walls. And that it's the same type of resistance that you will have and are feeling in this country today. Even though they were having the hell bombed out of them by Bomber Harris and company, they still would put up those paper Nazi flags and those signs saying, you may break our walls, but not our hearts. And that is something that we can apply to America today and those people who are in those masses who support Donald Trump as if they are apostolates awaiting the host.
Agreed. So here's the question then, Jim. What do you do about the hard cases and the dead enders? Because it appears that the hard cases and the dead enders are fully one-third, at least one-third of the American electorate.
And that's enough, because it only took one-third of the Nazis to come to power, 37.4. And, you know, I don't know what you could do with them. I really don't. I have no answer for that. If I had the answer to that, I'd be higher than a grade 15 up in Washington right now. But all I can say is this. The only thing you can do is to, first, what I would do, and I listened to your conversation with that learned professor, you know, take these statues away from positions where they can be defaced. Put them in a special place available to historical research and other things of that nature. And you're going to have people who are going to worship them as shrines. They are. That's just the way they are. But the main thing is to try to put the fire out as much as you possibly can.
Yeah, well, after the fall of the Soviet Union in some of the satellite states, you may well be aware, Hungary comes immediately to mind. They have a park where they took all of the Soviet era iconography, the Lenin statues, the Stalin statues,
Dzerzhinsky,
and they put them all in one place.
Yep.
And they did exactly what Dr. Phillips suggested.
That's a good idea.
They put interpretive language there that explains what these people did to the people of, in that case, Hungary.
Mm-hmm. I wish the Russians could do the same thing. What they did, they just pulled them down. And, you know, it started in 1956 after Stalin died. He died in 1953. and Khrushchev came to power and had his secret speech in 22nd February of 56, if I'm not correct, who debunked Stalin and his excesses. And, you know, that's when they called it the thaw. And, you know, eventually these things came to pass. These things are incremental. They are not immediate. And there's no immediate solution to it. But the main thing you can do is to at least gather these relics, or whatever you want to call them, and put them together and try to explain in as best fashion as one can what these people did and what happened because of what they did. And, you know, there's a lot of hero worship as far as, like, Stonewall Jackson is concerned. Robert E. Lee. I mean, there are in the South. I grew up there. I grew up worshiping these people. I grew up with a mother who, at every Confederate Memorial Day, with her friends from the UDC and the DAR, who would decorate the flags on the cemetery gates. I know whereof they speak. I understand of which certain parts of these people come. I do. And I'm trying to share it with you as best I can, because I know how you feel about it. But, you know, that's just the way it is. You know, eventually, through generational passage, as long as we have any type of educational system in everywhere who can understand exactly what really happened. But then I wonder about that. I mean, we've had an educational system that has described Hitler, Goering, Goebbels, and all that crowd, and still you've got a resurgence of it. And even Goering at Nuremberg predicted that one day they would be erecting statues to him. And I can say this from a personal standpoint. I had an uncle in Patton's Third Army, and he was detailed to guard the cell block, one of the cell blocks in Nuremberg. He had Goering, he had von Ribbentrop, and I think that's all that Andrews, Colonel Andrews, his superior officer, would let him have. Or maybe it was one. But he remembered, well, one, and this may be apocryphal, Ribbentrop said that, you know, he was sorry for what he did. He'd see them all in heaven. Okay, good. And I don't think old Jack wanted Goering's autograph the way some other guys did, that guy who snuggled that poison into him. And what I'm just saying is there are a lot of things that were said, and there, and you yourself told about you when your travels in Germany were, how there was a resurgence of that type of movement.
Yeah, and I mean, they don't fly the swastika. They don't refer to themselves as National Socialists. They are the AfD. They are the Alternative für Deutschland. But they're Nazis.
Whatever.
I mean, that's the name of the party. That's the name of the party, Alternative für Deutschland.
The only reason they don't fly the Broken Cross is because it's illegal, and they'd be put in jail. And they do that under the permissive laws of the existing German government. But all they have to do is take one flag down and run up another. And that's exactly what happened in 1930, 33, when they ran down the old German flag and put up Hitler's hacking cruise or Broken Cross flag.
And of course, it's what's happening now, as Dr. Phillips pointed out, because they figured out the equivalence between the Confederate battle flag and the Hakenkreuz. And they fly it, and they've been flying it. I mean, I think I've got a Jason Ringenberg album in the collection here called Empire Builder, and it's from 2004, and there's a song in there, I've played it, you've probably heard it, called A Rebel Flag in Germany, about the shock that he had of seeing the Confederate flag flying in Germany in, you know, 2002, 2003.
There you go. There you go. And the Confederate flag was based on what? The Sanders Cross and some other elements to it. And, you know, I will say this, and don't get me wrong here. For God's sakes, do not get me wrong. The Confederate flag was. It wasn't. From the standpoint of visual arts. Neither was Hitler's flag. It was extremely impressive. From visual arts, It caught your attention. It brought your eyes right to it, from the red to the white to the broken cross.
Yeah.
And it swayed millions.
No one will ever say that in either instance that they were not effective in their imagery.
Oh, and neither were the SS and the Hugo Boss uniforms.
Yeah.
No. I mean, they had style in their own sense.
Well, and you can argue a hell of a lot more than the guy in the tie-dyed T-shirt who tried to cut the covering off of Robert E. Lee today in Charlottesville. I mean, really,
no, I don't know.
Tie-dyed
I'm
T-shirt.
Not sure.
Yeah, he went. They put a tarp over the Robert E. Lee statue in Charlottesville until they get around to doing something with it, and the crazy old pro-Confederate goober went after it with a knife and was carrying a gun at the time.
There you go.
Wearing a tie-dyed T-shirt.
And you know what I fear to you, and I've emailed you this before, I really feel like this is not 33%. I think it is a lot more. I think that basically what we're looking at is only a tip of the iceberg. And we know what the tip of the iceberg did to a great ship who thought it was not something to worry about and they could steer around it. Most of it was underwater.
Yep.
And that's where a lot of this stuff is. And, you know, I've been made fun of and I have been decried because I have referenced this period of history before. Oh, no, this can't happen here. Oh, no, you're just full of. And I said, no, I'm not.
No, I don't. It can always happen anywhere. When people get tired, I mean, they're, you know, history. There's a lot that goes into the rise of these sort of fascist populist movements. Disenchantment, anger,
hunger,
bigotry, racism, economic. I don't buy that economic anxiety argument with regard to Trump. I never did, because there's a whole hell of a lot of difference between the inflation in Weimar Germany and Barack Obama's presidency dragging the economy back from the abyss to which George W. Bush took it.
Well, I think Obama did help a great deal with that. It is responsible for it, and Trump has tried to take credit for it. But, you know, even then, with the stock market the way it is, we are on parallel to where we were in 1929 with increasing closeness. We really are. It is a bubble. You've got all these people who are making all these gazillions of money. It's just soaring, soaring, soaring. And what must go up will come down, and it will come down.
Well, Jim, you said something a minute ago, and I want to come back. I want to take us back to it because it's too easy to just blow past it and not treat it with the gravity it deserves. You said you think this neo-fascist, right-wing, neo-Nazi Klan, whatever, you think that movement is a lot bigger than most people give credit for.
I do.
I mean, did I misunderstand you in that?
No, sir, you did not. I do believe it is.
Okay. Would you please flesh that out a little bit?
There are a lot of people who don't really make themselves known. They are just kind of quiet, and they're not active. But they look at their TV sets, they listen to whatever medium they have available, and they say, you know, I don't know if I can get out there and do that, but, you know, he just might be right. And there are a lot of people who did that, who have done that. And I think that is a definite element which constitutes a lot of the sub portions of the iceberg. I really believe that. And I've always believed that. How long have you and I been talking, Bob? Years.
Yeah, 13 years.
And I have always said that ever since we were talking on this program. I have always said that. That's one thing you cannot fault me for. And people have made fun of me for it. They have decried me for it. But now it's here. And we have a person who is actually there, who is an absolute maniac.
And is willing to weaponize them,
activate
them.
You know, there used to be a certain element of command structure as far as weapons are concerned. That's been taken out. And like as I said earlier in one of the other programs today, that bastard has the absolute authority to send an EAM
Now, message. Absolutely. Now, there was one thing that happened last night, Jim, that you might find interesting. At one point in mid-rave, he said, "And my new chief of staff, the great general John Kelly, is with us here tonight. John Kelly, come on up here. Say hi to the people. John Kelly, where are you? Come on up, John Kelly." You know what happened? John Kelly never came up, Jim.
Well, that tells you something about how the military are feeling, and also what is going on in the corridors of power in the Pentagon, where they realize they have an absolute maniac who is in control. I mean, this is what happened in certain circles of the German military when Adolf Hitler was beginning to make these promises and not keep them, when he was also rearming for a specific purpose. They knew what he was doing. And, of course, Hitler, eliminated a lot of those generals who were against him. And then because of the successes, the rest of the generals just said, well, maybe he's right, or I can't do it. And even when the last real opportunity to have to shoot that son of a bitch was when he was in Vinnytsia, his headquarters in the Russian Ukraine, and von Kluge was going to take out his revolver and shoot that bastard. And you know what excuse he gave? I couldn't shoot a man at lunch. And Jesus. That's where they put that bomb on board that didn't go off because of the freezing temperature. And it was, you know.
Well, in the modern version, John Kelly and Masterson and is it Masterson? And Mattis. Why am I drawing a blank? Well, anyway, they're retired from the military, but they are not without. They're not without contacts in the Pentagon still. They got a bunch of old poker playing and drinking buddies back there yet.
Oh yeah.
And you got to presume they still talk.
Well, you know, Stauffenberg, who tried to kill Hitler in July 44, had a lot of friends who had been cashiered because of Hitler. They didn't support him. Beck, and they even came forward. And they got shot. Beck had to kill himself as they found out his plot didn't work.
What I'm trying to get at is that.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to get off on.
No, that's okay. I want to get your thoughts on this. I've said for a long time that if Section 4 of the 25th Amendment was ever to be triggered, you know, it takes something like 9 members of the cabinet to do that, plus the consent of the vice president.
Well, I'm sorry. You're talking to people who are foxes tending the hen house.
Yeah, but you've got people like Mattis. And that's the thing. John Kelly is not in the cabinet. He's chief of staff.
Well, the thing about it is these guys feel so bound to their oaths of office and this, that, and the other. And because of their natural military assertion to honor same, it takes a hell of a lot of emphasis for them to break that oath. Literally, that's what they would have to do. Is to take action against the president, realizing that he is no longer competent, that he is leading their country into absolute, or our country.
And that's the question I was going to ask. You know, do you just sit there and go, well, my duty to the president is greater than my duty to the country, so he's nuts, and he's going to burn this place to the ground, but, you know, oh, my duty, my honor.
Well, the thing about it is, you can look back on the attentat of 1944, you see what happened.
Yeah, I'm not. But again, I'm not talking about anybody planting bombs or anything. I'm talking about a legal process that is enshrined in the Constitution.
About legal process. I'm afraid that's out the window. I'm sorry. It's going to take an extraordinary measure to neutralize this man. It will. He will never relinquish power. Never.
Well, that's another question that this country has never faced since the ratification of the Constitution. We have never actually convicted a president in the Senate after an impeachment, because and that is, you know, that's undiscovered country. We don't know what happens when you tell a president that he's got to go. Now,
I think the measure will come with the increase of the debt. Yeah, if he could get that through.
Well, he held that hostage last night, Jim.
Well, look it out. Look out.
He
for
said
it.
He's willing. But he's willing to. He's willing to insist upon
building that wall.
On not raising the debt ceiling unless he's given the money to build the wall that he said that he said Mexico was going to pay for in the first place.
That goddamn wall is crazy. It's fixed fortifications. Anybody who has any military training can realize that anything fixed in fortifications can be overcome land, sea, or air. They are obsolete. Totally.
And don't forget, he wants holes in it so that we can see the drug runners throwing 60-pound bags of drugs over the wall that might otherwise hit people on the head.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right. I remember that song by Mose Allison about him, which applies to him exactly. If Talk was criminal, he'd lead a life of crime because his mouth is on vacation and his mind is on vacation and his mouth is working overtime. And that's exactly what we have in here. But it's gone beyond that. I mean, this guy, every time I see him, he gets more and more bizarre. More and more just unbalanced.
And again, I return to my thesis, Jim. If you watch that thing, start to finish, 77 miserable, crazy minutes, if you sit down and watch that with the analytical eye that you would bring to it based upon your years of government service, your military service, your knowledge of history, if you can sit down and watch that and say that that's just another Trump rally, if you can sit down and watch that and say, sit down and watch that and not, I mean, you know, I will give credence to your counsel. If you tell me that this country, because I watched it, I sat here in wide-eyed horror and watched the whole thing start to finish while I was doing, you know, the stuff that I have to do after the program's over. And I was shaken, Jim. And like you said, we've been talking for 13 years. There are not a lot of conversations in the archives of this broadcast in which I tell you that I am shaken. Last night, I came to the conclusion, and I'm just going to hammer it home, and on your nickel in this case, I came to the conclusion last night that this country is in grave peril.
Agreed. Wholeheartedly.
I mean, we don't have political problems. We don't have domestic. We have existential problems that begin and end with the presidency of Donald J. Trump.
Yes, we do. We absolutely do. And, you know, this guy got up there and he propelled himself into the presidency or was propelled by a bunch of people who heard a bunch of shit that they just wanted to hear. And it tells me, number one, the stupidity, lack of education, lack of ability to perceive or even think properly of those people who were in those rallies. And I remember those rallies, throw the bum out, get him out, get him out, get him out, get him out, and all this kind of stuff.
Hey, if anybody beats him up, I'll pay their legal bills.
Yeah, and I said, oh, my God, oh, my God.
And so what must it have been if I'm sitting here and telling you that last night was worse than any campaign rally, including all of that?
You got it, baby. That's the worst one I've ever seen or I've caught snippets of and have heard evaluations of. I mean, this is absolute going to ground zero of a problem, and he is right there at it. And he's the one who's going to try to do it. And, you know, like I say, I am really afraid of this man. I am totally afraid of him. He is nihilistic. And those are the other words we can use. And the other words have been used a lot more effectively than anything that I could ever say. But he is a nihilist. He is he can self-destruct. I don't know what's going on in his mind. Because
see, that's the thing, Jim. We don't know at this point if there is a mind. I mean,
there's a mind there. Oh, absolutely.
I don't know that. Okay, I try to look at things in perspective. I remember the reign of error under Dim Leader. Okay, and we were all pretty well convinced that he, you know, not that bright, and probably a dry drunk.
But not so.
All of that pales. All of that pales in comparison to this, Jim.
You got it. I would prefer to have W back than any of Trump. Absolutely. I can remember W's father. You know, W's father, Bush 41, was a reasonable man. He really was. I mean, he was the first to decry voodoo economics. He was the first to do a lot of things. He made mistakes. But George Bush 41 and Bush 43, compared to this demagogue and this poltroon, whatever you want to call him, this dangerous man, is on the verge of bringing our nation and the rest of the world with him to ruin. And I really think that he would be capable of issuing what is called a Nero order. If I can't have it, I will take it with me.
Burn it to the ground. Yep.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, in support of your argument about the futility of fixed fortifications, Robert in Australia says $30 billion wall versus Amazon drone. Bob, $30 billion wall versus Amazon home delivery drone. That's an Amazon home delivery drone modified by the drug runners. Drone wins.
Well, they got it. I mean, you know, anything man can build. Even George Patton said that. I said this before in our conversations. Even Patton realized that. They fixed fortifications. And this guy has studied the Germans and this, that, and the other fixed fortifications. He had fought in World War I, and he realized how obsolete they were. But yet people put some type of protection in what they call the Maginot Line.
And the Germans, too, in the Siegfried Line.
Well, guess what they did? They didn't depend on the Siegfried Line, but the French sure as hell did. And guess what von Manstein did? He went straight around it, bypassed it, because it was not connected through Belgium.
Right, because Belgium is a sovereign state, and France couldn't build exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, I think they were trying to work something out. But even then, you had Panzers, and you had types of incredibly new stratagems that worked. Even the Nazis themselves were overcome by their successes. They were scared to say, oh, you can't believe it. I mean, Hitler studied 6 weeks, what we could do in 4 years. But not get up to too much like that, you know. You have these people who have a certain charisma and a certain repetitive speech and, you know, the big lie. And that is exactly what Trump does. Whatever he says, he speaks academically. Anything he says, you can exactly not take to the bank, because whatever he says, you cannot believe. And I just don't understand this. And as somebody like him could be the head of our government, we are laughed at by the rest of the world. But in addition to that, the rest of the world fears us, and they fear what can happen to them because of what he does. I mean, we're talking about the most powerful man in the world, other than Vladimir Putin, and I'm sure he has his codes too.
I no doubt. Well, Jim, I appreciate the conversation. I really, really do. You have yourself a good evening,
well,
all right?
Sorry, could have been better, but you know, there it is.
Hey, look, you know, it's hard to laugh it up and yuck it up about the, you know, your country facing an existential crisis.
You know, Bob, I hate to think that all of the efforts of the world. And let me say this to you. We've gone through so many wars. And what were they about? They were declared, all these people were going, oh, yeah. And then when they were over, they said to them, what did we fight about? What was it really about? When they stood among ruined cities and disrupted lives and the millions of dead. What was this really all about other than some type of ego type of situation? And people who thought they could, I'm being very kind to these people. Their reach exceeded their grasp, and they were absolutely stupid. And, you know, if I could pick out everyone in history who was responsible for these wars and stuff like that, they would be at the nearest portion of hell. But, you know, they did it. And they did it for selfish reasons. And a lot of it was driven by ego. And it was.
See, there's nothing that Trump does that isn't driven by ego. He doesn't. That's the whole point. He doesn't even have. There's no political calculus there. To that extent, Scarborough was right. He's sacrificing 66% of the country's vote for that of 33%, and then the Republican Party will go, okay, we got 33%. We got to gin up 17%.
Well, if they can do that, then they deserve to be destroyed. They really do.
And that's where it is. But there's no real political all he wants, and you know, even Jesus, the monsters of history that we've discussed, they had more perspicacity than what Trump does. Trump wants more fame. Trump wants more adoration. If Trump could force everyone to worship him at the point of a gun, by God, he'd do it.
Of course he would. And by the same token, if you want that point of the gun, then he just very well get what he wishes.
Well, let's be careful about things like that. I'd prefer not
to
have any visits.
I'm just saying that he may be well.
I don't think that threat exists for Trump. Okay. The Secret Service responded to more threats against Barack Obama than any number of presidents combined before him. That is not happening with Trump.
Well, you know, I don't think he's treated his Praetorian Guard with any great esteem.
No, as Carol noted a couple of nights ago,
in a trailer,
they're working for free now.
Yeah,
the budget is done.
But
here's the thing, Jim. When does the fiscal year begin in the United States government?
September 30th.
And so they're working for free from now till September 30th.
They're not going to do that. You know, that's one thing that Caligula made a mistake of. He made a mistake of disparaging his Praetorians, and those Praetorians, they took matters into their own hands.
You know, you went to Caligula. You know who I've been thinking about lately?
Did I not say Caligula?
You did say Caligula.
Okay.
But you know who I've been thinking about lately? And this may seem a little obscure. I've been thinking about a guy by the name of Sejanus, pronounced by some Sejanus. S-E-J-A-N-U-S.
Was he one of the military commanders who was stabbed by his own troops?
No, he was the enforcer for, I think, Tiberius. Tiberius didn't want... Tiberius grew tired of being emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll recall we refer to Trump as the Tangerine Tiberius. And
yeah, well, you know.
More or less retired to his...
and Capri.
Palatial estate on Capri.
Mm-hmm. Now, he did lots of strange things there.
But Sejanus, meantime...
did the dirty work for...
And was the enforcer and took people out for sedition and speaking ill of the emperor and ran his own personal reign of terror.
Yeah,
I've begun to wonder, Jim, who is the Sejanus? Now that Bannon's gone, who's the Sejanus inside the White House? Is it Seb Gorka?
I don't know.
Is it Steve Miller?
Know. I don't know. I guess it would have to be, you know, you have to just bait and switch and see which one comes up. I don't know.
Oh, and by the way, the general I was thinking of was McMasters. McMasters.
Yeah.
But it's not him. It's not John Kelly. But somebody is there feeding Trump's paranoia. And as far as I'm concerned, with Bannon gone, it just about has to narrow down to Seb Gorka or Stephen Miller.
Well, listen, Bannon ain't gone. Bannon's in a more powerful position than he ever was. He's out of the White House. He's in with Breitbart. and it can provide a more powerful emphasis to these people being out of the White House and any type of overreach that they may have on him.
Well, yeah, he's untouchable to them now.
Yeah, he is.
I don't know if you saw this or not. A prank was played by some internet prankster who was imitating, I think it was Bannon, I forget whom. But anyway, he got like the executive editor of that website that rhymes with light and fart to engage in an email colloquy with him in which the editor at Breitbart said, yeah, we're working on a story in which we're going to say that Jared is a Jew cuck of Ivanka.
A Jew cuck. I don't understand.
Cuck. C-U-C-K. That's a right wing. That's a.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. That Ivanka is out there around on Jared and cuckolding him because.
Well, what did I say about Jared?
He's another monster. And I'm wondering I'm wondering if he's the Sejanus.
I don't know. Well, Jared, I told you, I thought my gaydar went up years ago or months ago when I talked, or weeks ago, and I think he's made more than one trip to the ATM boy bank. There's something about him.
Wait a minute. We haven't had a cowbell all night. ATM boy bank, cowbell for Jim.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
But, I mean, this guy, this Jared, he is just I don't know what, a poltroon. I'm not going to get dirty or whatever. He's just a very dishonest person who comes from a very dishonest family, and he runs a hell of a place in Maryland with those apartment complexes, and he does all these horrible things to people to whom he perceives owe him money. And he's no better than his father-in-law. I mean, you know, when Ivanka whoever chose him to marry, or he agreed to have Jared marry his daughter. Well, okay, they were right in line. That's for damn sure. But nonetheless, getting back to the thing with Trump and all these people who surround him, he only deals with those people who will tell him how good he is and not disagree with him. If they know if they disagree with him, they're going to be out. And then what other measures he might take against them. But like I say, Trump can get to a certain point, and when he isolates, number one, his own Praetorian Guard, the Secret Service, and number two, in the military starting to feel as though, look, my oath of office only depends on one thing, and I cannot support someone who subverts the Constitution. Now, in Germany, when these officers would come together and talk about overthrowing Hitler, they even went to a Catholic church and asked the priest to give them absolution for breaking the Fahrenheit or the oaths of the Fuhrer. That's what they did. And each man, in his own way, I guess, will have to go through that type of mental process. Because I've taken that oath before, and I know what it means, and it still means a great deal for me. I've taken it many times, going in many jobs, but I realize that this man does not represent the Constitution. He represents his own ego, mad-driven personality. I mean, if you have an arm that's gangrenous, what do you do with it?
I know. Well, Jim, we got to get out of here because we're right at it. Seconds left in the program. You have
thank
a good
you,
evening.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate your time, Bob.
Take care now.
And by the way, I gave you a very good compliment on Randy Rhodes.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you kindly. I appreciate it.
And I told her that you were the one who gave me access to her and the whole Progressive Voices Network.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
You did.
Take care.
You did. And I'm going to have to pay you back one day for that when I'm able, okay?
Later now. All right. Bye.
Out here.
Our buddy Jim. Thanks for the kind words to Randy. That was very nice. Oh, by the way, Sejanus was played in the BBC I, Claudius series, as Kim reminds me, played by Patrick Stewart. If you want to see Patrick Stewart with hair, as and Kim describes him as very sexy. played with great flair. Okay. Jack in Shreveport says, yeah, I heard Jim on Randy. Well, thanks for that, Jim. Thank you. Time to get out of here in a real hurry. Thanks, everybody who supports the program. We are still $273 in the hole. That means $473 tomorrow, depending on what the overnight crew does. Thanks to everybody who makes this program go. Time is short to do the whole list, but thank you, one and all. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night.